This is Jason Stewart with the Vietnam Archive at Texas Tech University, conducting an oral history interview with Mr. Ray Curran. Today is November 16, 2010. I'm in Lubbock, Texas, in the Special Collections Library on the campus of Texas Tech, and Mr. Curran is joining me by phone from Arizona. Is that correct?
Yes.
Okay. All right. Why don't we begin, if we could, with a little bit of biographical information. When and where were you born?
I was born August 20th of 1942 in Omaha, Nebraska.
Okay. All right. Did you grow up there in Omaha?
Yes.
Okay. All right. Could you tell me, I guess, a little bit about your parents? What were their names and what did they do for a living?
My mother was Blanche, and she was a homemaker. And my father was William, and he worked for Kellogg's Company, the breakfast food folks, for many, many years. Had a good job. He was in management.
Yes, sir. All right. Well, as a kid growing up, did you have any relatives that had served in the military? Anyone in World War II? Anything like that?
Yeah. A couple of uncles who were in World War II. Neither one went to either Europe or the islands in the Pacific, but they were both in the Army. And one was a captain who trained infantrymen in Hawaii, I suppose those who went into the Pacific after the Marines took the islands.
Okay. Yes,
I had a couple of good friends and neighbors who were both heavily in combat, one in North Africa and Italy, and the other one in the Pacific.
Okay. All right. Well, if you don't mind, if you could talk a little bit about, I guess, what growing up in Omaha was like for you.
Well, it was good. I lived in a neighborhood called South Omaha, which was actually near the stockyards and near all the packing plants that were there in the 40s and 50s and 60s.
Okay.
Went to a local parochial grade school with nun teachers and sister teachers, and then went to a Jesuit high school called Creighton Prep.
Okay.
Played all kinds of sports on the playgrounds and in grade school. And the high school I went to was so good in sports I didn't even bother to try out, but I did play on what was called Catholic Youth Organization sports.
Okay.
In the religion vein, I had my mother's brother was a Catholic priest, and my father's sister was a Catholic nun. Lived around all kinds of my father and mother's brothers and sisters, and I only had one cousin, however, but I was close to a lot of relatives, and grandfather and grandmother from different parents. I had a great childhood, in my opinion, and had a lot of fun. And
all right, yes, sir. All right. Well, as a kid growing up, did you pay any attention to, I guess, what was going on in the world with the development of the Cold War, U.S. foreign policy, that type of thing?
Yeah, I would say so.
Okay.
I remember coming home from the grade school I went to. We left there and went home and ate lunch at home, and for some reason, it could have been in the morning, it could have been at night, but for some reason I tied in with lunch listening about the Korean War, for instance. I was 8 in 1950, and a friend of mine's brother was killed in Korea. I remember that. And I remember the drills in case there was a attack from the Soviet Union and that kind of stuff.
Like the duck and cover type things?
Exactly.
Okay, yes, sir. All right. What was your, as a kid, again, what was your impression of, I guess, of the Russians and of the larger threat of communism?
Oh, I believed what I heard. Mm-hmm. And, of course, the nuns that taught us knew about the suppression of religion in the Soviet Union, so they fired us up a little bit. But,
sure.
Yeah, I believe they were the enemy at that time. I believed it.
Mm-hmm. All right.
And the separation of Berlin. I remember the Berlin Wall. I think I certainly remember soon afterwards, and that sort of thing.
Mm-hmm. Okay. All right. Let's see. Well, what year did you graduate from high school?
60.
60. All right. All right. And upon graduation, what did you do at that point?
I went to a place called Omaha University, and you know what? That's not right. I went to Creighton University for 2 years, and I transferred to Omaha University and graduated from there in 65, double major in English history and English literature, and I then went to graduate school in history, and I did something called an internship where you teach breakout classes from the big lectures and you help the PhDs do some busy work and stuff like that. But eventually what did I do? I went a year and a half and I dropped out even though I knew I would be drafted. Mm-hmm. And I was. And I don't know if I'm getting ahead of you or not, but anyway, that's my educational experience.
Okay. Yes, sir. Well, you said you went for your master's in history?
I went in English history. Yeah, the head of the department was an Englishman who, I can't think of the name of the college he got his PhD. I don't know. His name was A. Stanley Trickett. I do remember that.
Okay. Well, just out of curiosity, what was your interest in English history? What did you focus on?
Mainly the 17th and 18th century. That's what
okay. Yes, sir. All right. Let's see. As you were going through college and the master's program, of course, was this? You said this was around 65 or so that you were.
Yeah.
Okay.
It was actually 66, and the first semester of 67.
Okay. Well. Were you paying attention at that point with the developments in Southeast Asia and what was going on in Vietnam?
Sure. I no more so than the average person, probably. However, I mean, I read the papers and occasionally watched television news.
Mm-hmm.
And if anything, I probably got the anti-war side from the magazines I read.
Mm-hmm.
I read some pretty wild left-wing magazines and stuff.
All right. Had you developed much of an opinion on the war then at that point?
I probably bought Kennedy's line that it was necessary.
Mm-hmm.
You know, although he was certainly not in it when it got heavy. But I thought we had business being there.
Well, yes, sir. All right. Well. During that time going to college, were there any anti-war activities going on?
Hardly at all, in Omaha. Hardly at all.
Mm-hmm.
Nothing like I saw on television from the coast.
Mm-hmm.
Nothing like that.
What did you think of the anti-war stuff that you were seeing on TV? Did you have much of an opinion about it?
Yeah, I thought it was. Young people not wanting to go into the service.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't ascribe to them too many noble sentiments. I thought they were having too much fun smoking dope and running with women, and I've thought that then, and I actually think that now.
All right, yes, sir. All right. Well, as you're going through college and things begin to heat up in Vietnam, did you have any friends or people from anyone from your hometown that you had known that had already gone over, had already served?
Sure.
Mm-hmm.
Yep. And most of the people that were drafted that I knew didn't make it to Vietnam, but a few did.
Okay. All right. And did you, paying attention to all of this, did you think that there was a possibility that eventually you yourself would be serving in Vietnam?
Yeah, sure.
Mm-hmm.
Yep.
All right. You said as you were going through grad school, it was at that point that the draft board began, getting close, paying attention to you, or?
You know what? I don't remember what my number was. I just assumed that I would get drafted. you know, I was, even though I was 24 years old, I didn't think that mattered, and of course it didn't. Mm-hmm. And I knew I would get drafted, but I thought that was okay. Everybody else was.
Right. Yes, sir. All right.
Actually, a lot of my friends joined the service in the early 60s and were out before there was any chance of going to war, because a lot of my friends had no intention to go into college. They grew up in blue-collar families, and that's just the way it was.
Right. All right. Had you ever given any thought to joining the military prior to being drafted?
No.
Okay. All right. Well, at what point, I guess, did you receive your draft notice?
I received my draft notice, I'm thinking it was April of 67.
Mm-hmm.
However, I then broke my hand on a friend's head, unfortunately.
All right.
And didn't go until the, you know, they, I went to my, I got the break set. It was a boxer's fracture, they call it.
Mm-hmm.
And I took a letter to the draft board, and they said, okay, we'll defer you for a couple of months, if that's the right word. And I said, okay. And then I got a letter saying to report to a certain place in downtown Omaha on July 24th, I think, 67.
Okay. All right. Was that for the for your physical?
Gosh, I don't remember
okay.
that.
Sure.
I don't know if it was – I don't remember the – if I went the day I took the physical or not. I don't know how that works. I can't remember.
Okay, sure. No problem.
I got a hunch you didn't. I think I took the physical and a week or two later went.
Okay. All right. Well, I know you seemed to be kind of a, you thought it was a strong possibility. It didn't seem to bother you. But how about your family? How did they feel about you being drafted?
I just think they thought it was a normal course of things. Mm-hmm. My brother, the year before, had graduated from law school and joined the Navy rather than wait to get drafted. So he was a lawyer in the Navy, and so he was already in a rather cushy job in Philadelphia. But, you know, I when I was drafted, I doubt seriously whether my folks knew I would be in the infantry.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
College graduate, blah, blah, blah. But they should have known better.
Right.
But they didn't.
Okay. All right. Well, I guess from what you remember, what was the process from whenever you had to report and after having your physical, where did it go from there? How long before you had to report for basic training?
I'm not sure.
Okay.
I'd say less than a month, but I really can't remember.
Mm-hmm. All right. Okay.
See, the thing was is that since I broke my arm there and I got that extra 2 months, I had maybe a longer period than most people
mm-hmm.
between induction notice and going than they did.
Right.
Okay. So I just can't remember the time frame.
Yes, sir. Sure. All right. Where did you go through basic?
Fort Benning, Georgia.
Okay. All right. And I guess if you could, if you wouldn't mind talking about a little bit about what basic training was like for you.
Well, I was with people that were 5-6 years younger than me in a lot of cases. I didn't necessarily like that.
Mm-hmm.
And a strange thing was that I was injured with, I can't remember exactly. It was stress fractures in my right leg.
Mm-hmm.
And so I sat out for like 6 weeks, kind of like breaking my hand. And I just helped him in the kitchen during that period. And then I had to go to when that was over and they said, you can go back to basic, I went to a fresh start basic training company because this happened like 3 weeks in. And even earlier than that, I had a kidney stone that passed, which was unbelievable. You know, an interesting thing was the doctor there said, for some reason, people pass kidney stones in this geographic area a lot. He says, I don't know what it's got to do with, but it happens.
Mm-hmm.
So I was in basic, or at least the basic training at Fort Benning, probably 5 weeks longer than I should have been.
Right.
And then basic training after that. I actually got in with a company with older guys. I didn't mind it quite so much. I don't know if they didn't do it on purpose, not the Army. But I didn't mind basic training that much. I probably lost 20 pounds. I was, probably 20 pounds overweight. And I don't know. I didn't mind it that much. Mm-hmm. A lot of physical exercise that was easy enough to do, but still, it got me in shape. And as it turned out, it was good to be in shape when I got to Vietnam.
Yes, sir. Well, did they ever give you a hard time about being a college grad?
Yes. Mm-hmm. I made the mistake once to raise my hand when they asked that question.
Right.
Never made that mistake again, even though it's in my records. There's no sense volunteering that information.
Sure.
Yeah, the guy that did it was the typical Southern sixth grade educated, I'm making that up,
right,
drill sergeant.
Uh-huh. Sure.
He didn't like college graduates.
All right. At the time, as far as weapons training is concerned, were you guys still on the M14 or had they moved to the M16?
No, yet? M14.
M14, okay. All right. Well, now you briefly mentioned the DI, but could you talk a little bit more about the instructors there? And were they Vietnam vets, for one thing?
I'm going to say that out of three, maybe one of them. Well, wait a minute. I take that back. I don't know if they were or not, but one of them wore the combat infantryman's badge, which it could have been Korea, but it was probably Vietnam. Mm-hmm. You're familiar with that?
Yes, sir.
Okay.
All right. Overall, did you find the training to be pretty sufficient as far as at least an introduction into the Army?
Sure. Yeah, absolutely.
Okay. All right.
There was a lot of breaking you down into, you were always in squads and fire teams, and learning how you had to work together and stuff like that. I would say they did a decent job.
Mm-hmm. All right.
It was a little, then I went to infantry training, and that was good.
Mm-hmm. Okay. How would they do things like enforce discipline?
Scare the living hell out of you,
Right.
I mean, I would say in basic, that's their main way of teaching.
Mm-hmm.
Intimidation.
All right. Any particularly memorable moments or even funny moments, anything like that from basic that sticks out that you could possibly mention?
Oh man, I don't.
All right.
No, I don't remember that.
Okay.
I remember a lot more of the next training than I do the basic.
Okay, sure. All right. And where'd you go through the AIT at then?
Fort Polk, Louisiana.
Fort Polk, okay. Was that Tigerland?
Yeah, it was indeed.
Okay. All right. How long was that training? Did you have any setbacks there or?
No, no problem. I went to basic length, maybe 9 weeks, maybe 12. I don't remember which. Probably nine.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that was tough. I mean, it was. I was ready for it, but we ran everywhere we went. If we were going to the firing range and it was 4 miles off, fine. We ran or not breakout speed, but we trotted or whatever. And it was rainy there. I was there in January and, in December and January, and it rained a lot in that part of the world at that time. And so we always had our puncho liners on. And when the clouds would break and it would then get hot, or at least 80 probably,
right,
we left the puncho liners on as just a toughening process, I guess. So I remember that.
Yes, sir. All right. As far as the focus of the training, was it things like just basic infantry tactics, or do you remember how?
No, it was geared to Vietnam.
Okay.
They had a mock village, stuff like that, and I guess the one thing that would have made you think of World War II was when we went through the live fire thing, we low crawled quite a distance with live ammunition going over our head. And even though that could be attributed to almost any modern war, it made me think of World War II more than anything.
Okay.
You know, if you stood up, they told you you'd get killed. And I don't know if that's true or not, but without question, rounds were breaking the sound barrier over your head and stuff like that. It was,
right.
It was getting shot at.
Yes, sir. All right. Well, again, in this training, were the instructors here, were they Vietnam vets?
Yeah.
Okay.
Without question, they were all infantry, Vietnam and Ranger guys.
All right. Did they? Do you ever remember them talking much about their tours? Or
yeah. They tell incidents, and they try to get us ready for what we were going to see, and I think they tried to get in us a healthy respect for the enemy, which was a good idea.
Yes,
stuff like that. And they, for some reason, I remember them spending an inordinate amount of time if we got separated from our company, and we had to evade the enemy and live off the land. My memory is that I thought they spent too much time on that, but maybe that's because I never got separated from my company.
So there was a little bit of that survival type.
Oh, yeah,
training.
Absolutely.
Okay.
There was.
All right. All right.
And a lot of weapons training and some tactics, I guess it'd be called.
Mm-hmm. Okay. All right. Have you seen the movie Tigerland?
No.
Okay.
I'm familiar with it,
okay.
But I did not see it.
I was going to ask your opinion if you thought it was realistic.
Okay. I don't know. I didn't watch it. I may have watched it a long time ago, but I don't remember it that well. I don't think I did.
Okay.
Tigerland's a tough place, though. I mean, it was a tough place. If it showed that, then I would agree with it. If it showed evil, nasty drill sergeants, I wouldn't agree with it. We did not have that in Tigerland.
It was little bit of both. It showed it as a tough place, but there was, if I remember correctly, in the film, at least one evil drill sergeant. But that's...
I didn't have that.
Right.
it's possible for that to have occurred without a doubt, but I didn't have it.
Right. But typical, or stereotypical, rather, Hollywood movies.
So yeah,
you
sure.
You got to have an evil drill sergeant in there.
Yeah.
But, all right. Well, any memorable moments or funny moments from AIT?
Okay, AIT. Memorable moments, it was learning about the gas mask. I suppose in companies, we went down to this building about the size of a 2,000 square foot house, probably. You know, it wasn't gigantic or anything.
Mm-hmm.
And we put on our gas masks and marched through there, and there was CS gas being piped into the place.
Mm-hmm.
That was okay. We went out. Nobody had a problem, I don't think. The masks, I think some people had problems with the masks in general, but then we went through it again, which I didn't quite understand why, and they made us take our masks off inside.
Mm-hmm.
That was not good. And I don't remember if we put them back on or not. And we left. We were coughing, spitting, doing all that. And while we were sitting there recovering, they, outside, threw a couple of CF gas canisters at us.
Oh, no.
Yeah, just to top that off. So I won't forget that, I don't suppose.
Mm-hmm.
The interesting thing was, I think most people probably went through Vietnam without ever being gassed. Well, we were... My company was gassed one time. We had landed on top of a underground hospital complex, and they wanted to get us out of there. And, of course, we didn't have our gas masks. We were issued them and never carried them. But anyway,
yes, sir.
So I didn't particularly panic because of what I'd gone through in Tigerland, I guess.
Right. Yes, sir.
Yeah.
Oh.
And, the other things I remember is I made a couple of good friends there and actually ended up with one of them in my company, which was very good.
Yes.
That was good. And unlikely, probably.
Right.
Because, I got over there in early February of 68, right after Tet, and they needed troops all over creation, but we ended up in the same company.
Mm-hmm. Yes, sir. All right. Well, I guess overall, did you feel that the training there at Tigerland, prepared you as best it could for what you would face in Vietnam?
I don't think I'd say that. Not as best you could, but physically, maybe.
Mm-hmm.
As best you could. But And the other thing was, everybody wanted out of there, and if the alternative was Vietnam, then that's fine. We wanted out of Tigerland. Mm-hmm. So in a way, I guess it might have prepared us, but I don't know. I didn't prepare me for the stuff I went through later.
Yes, sir. All right.
Well, psychologically.
Yes,
let's
sir.
Put it that way.
All right. Well, at that point in your progression of your training, did you know absolutely for sure that you would be going to Vietnam by the time you got to Tigerland, or was it still a possibility?
Oh, well, they talked like we were. I can't remember if somebody went somewhere else, if some of the guys went somewhere else or not, but... everybody to talk to us says you're going to Vietnam.
Mm-hmm. Right. And I know you guys wouldn't have had too much time because they were keeping you rather busy, but did you hear much at all about the developments, about what was going on over there in the days before you went?
I was on leave when Ted occurred, so Okay. There wasn't that. They couldn't have told me about that. I don't think so. I don't think they tried to keep us up on it. I think they talked more about their tours than they did about what was happening presently.
Mm-hmm. All right. Well, in their talk, discussing their tours, was it kind of in a teaching method, say, you got to look out for this type of thing?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. They told us about the different kind of landmines and what they'd experienced and how the Vietnamese would set up ambushes and attack at night and that kind of thing. Yeah, it was good. It was
mm-hmm. And you said that there was like things like mock villages for
yes.
I guess for village sweep. Did you have were there people playing villagers and that type
yeah,
of thing?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yep.
All right. Well, then I guess was it at the end of AIT that you received your assignment to Vietnam?
Yeah.
Okay. All right. And what was your reaction to that assignment?
I thought it was inevitable.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think I had any particular reaction.
All right.
I think I'd known it ever since I got orders to go to Fort Polk right after basic.
Mm-hmm.
I think I knew I'd go to Vietnam, and I think I knew I'd do it as an infantryman.
Yes, sir. All right. Well, I know you mentioned having a little time off between AIT and Vietnam.
Yeah.
What did you do during that time period?
I probably read books during the day and drank a lot of beer in the evenings. Chased some women.
Uh-huh. All right. All right. Once this leave was over with, what was the process of, I guess, leaving home and going to Vietnam?
My father took me to the airport in Omaha.
Mm-hmm.
I guess my mom didn't want to cry at the airport, probably. I took a commercial flight, obviously, to SeaTac Airport, Seattle-Tacoma Airport. Took a military bus to Fort Lewis, Washington. Maybe spent two nights there. And then took a bus to a military airport. I don't know the name of it. And... took what appeared for all intents and purposes to be a commercial flight to Vietnam.
Okay.
Kind of interesting was the stops we made.
Okay.
First stop, Hawaii. And then, and I don't know the order of these, I've never looked it up, Midway and Wake Island. You know, it was like a tableau of World War II famous sea battles.
Right.
I should have known what I was going to get through when that happened. But anyway, we stopped three or four times on the way to Vietnam.
Did you get a chance to get off the plane and see?
In Hawaii.
Okay.
Only in Hawaii. Honolulu, excuse me.
Okay.
And not the other two. Probably just refueling. I don't think anybody got on or off.
Right. All right. And the atmosphere on the plane ride over there, what were you guys talking at all about what to expect or...
Yeah, I think so. It was subdued, I would say. It wasn't, it was subdued. It was a lot of food, a lot of soda pop and coffee, but nobody seemed real happy where they're going.
Yes, sir.
It was mainly young E3s and the like going over there. There was a few sergeants, I think.
Okay.
I don't remember there being officers.
All right. And you said you arrived, it was February of 68, just after Tet?
Yeah, it was early, like the 6th or 7th, I think.
Okay. All right. Where did you come into country?
You know what? I'm not positive, and I hate to say that, but I think it was Saigon, but it could have been Cameron Bay.
Okay.
It's just that Cameron Bay was a pretty nice place and had new facilities for the most part, and it was pretty crappy where I spent the one night, and I just think it was probably Todd and Snit.
Okay. All right. Well, do you remember much about, I guess, your first impressions of Vietnam upon stepping off the plane?
It was hot,
mm-hmm.
which amazed me, since I just came from a very cold place.
Right.
Just bustling activity, you know, all kinds of military stuff everywhere. It was the busiest airport in the world, and I think it would still be the busiest airport in the world. I mean, the number of flights per day and that kind of stuff. It was a busy, busy place.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember that. And it's the first time I saw Vietnamese people, you know. There were a lot of them waiting to catch planes and stuff. I don't know where the hell they were going, but
mm-hmm.
That's when I first saw Vietnamese, and it was kind of, you know, I knew they were going to be small in stature, but that kind of
mm-hmm.
surprised me.
Were you at all, I guess, wary of them, concerned of their presence being there?
No, okay. None whatsoever. Another thing that I saw, I think, were combat veterans with their, you know, their look.
Mm-hmm.
And many kids, well, they certainly always had very scuffed boots and not the best fatigues and no rank and no way to know what outfit they were with. You know, I could tell a general could have walked by and they wouldn't have cared in the slightest. You know, and I don't think I'm embellishing that because that's how I turned out. I did see that at the airport. And I suppose they were going back to their battalion areas to go on R&R, maybe lucky enough to be going home. I don't know. But anyway, I saw that and thought, oh, my goodness.
Did, you see in the movies and I've read in the books, like, did any of them say anything to you guys about being, you know, the green guy, the greenies, the new guys coming?
Not at Tansanute, but they did later on at the, I don't know what to call it, in transit barracks we were in or something. Because some guys were done, and some guys were going on R&R, and
mm-hmm.
there we were. Yeah, they said stuff.
Mm-hmm.
You don't want to go there and stuff like that.
Right. All right. So once you arrived there, then it was to that kind of transit.
I think I just spent one night there. Then they sent me to the first cab, and maybe it was two nights, I don't know. But then they sent me to the first cab division headquarters. Oh, man, I can't remember the name. It was, you know, the name of the town close by.
Mm-hmm.
Holy smokes, I can't think of it.
Let's see, were they still around Anh Ke?
Yeah, it was Anh Ke.
Okay.
Yeah, that was a big place.
Okay. All right.
Go ahead. Well, we did about a week of training there,
mm-hmm.
which was good. I'm thinking that's the first time I fired the M16. I believe we did not have the M16 at Polk.
Okay, sir.
Fired at, I know this is backtracking, but we fired the 14 a lot, and we fired the M60, 50 caliber, M79 grenade launchers. I think we each fired a LAW light anti-tank weapon, even though the only tanks I saw were in the enemy tanks were in the Ashaw Valley. The LAW could come in handy for bunkers and stuff.
Mm-hmm. Yes, sir. All right. That week of training in country, what was that like? Do you remember much about it?
Yeah, I do. It was, you know, we paid attention. It was good. One of the things that concerned me was we rappelled off of a high tower several times. I don't know, three or four times.
I was thinking I really didn't want to do that off of a moving helicopter very bad. At the time, I thought that. You know, I didn't know how still they could be in the air, but there was that. We went out on outside the wire a couple of nights. Went on a patrol outside the wire. Fired the M16 and got some in-country class time about things not to do. There were some things they didn't want you to do.
Mm-hmm. All right. What about like booby traps and things that they
They showed us that. They had already done that at Pope, but they did it again here with, you know, more. I listened closer, I guess I'd say.
All right. When you mentioned things not to do, was it like cultural things? Like how to get along with the Vietnamese, I guess?
Yeah, and stuff that would get you in trouble discipline-wise. And they were, you know, this was the age of Aquarius, so they were warning us about heroin and marijuana and stuff like that.
Mm-hmm. Yes, sir. All right. You were, when you arrived at there at Anke, were you there for just a short time before?
I think it was a week. I think it was actually, you know, that's pretty long.
Right.
They were serious. First Cab was a serious group.
Mm-hmm. What actual unit were you assigned to from there? Do you remember?
I spent the rest of my year there in A Company, 1st to the 12th.
Okay. All right. Do you remember where they were?
I do. They were north of Quan Tri when I joined them. They were a blocking force for the NVA fleeing back to the DMZ after Quan Tri was a rather large battle in Tet, and of course, what's the perfume city? Wei was a hell of a battle for both the Marines and the 2nd of the 12th, and I think the 5th of the 12th were there. Lost all kinds of guys.
Sir.
I may be wrong about those battalions, but everybody thinks of the Marines when they think of Ted, but the Cav had two battalions there.
Right, sir. All right. So up there around there, you must have been pretty close to the DMZ then, correct?
Yes.
Okay.
I don't know how far. Not very far.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe 20 clicks. I don't know.
All right. Well, how did you get there from Anke? Was it by helicopter or...?
I took a C-130 from Saigon to Anke and took a Chinook, I guess C-54, whatever the hell they are, from Anke to LZ Sharon in Quan Tri, a large first Cav base, possibly the, I don't know. I'm not going to say that. I was going to say it's the only division base up there, a large one, but I don't know about that. But anyway, the 1st of the 12th and several other battalions, if not all of them, were on LZ Sharon. It was gigantic.
Okay. All right. was the company there at Sharon at that
point? No, they were out in the bush.
Okay. All right.
At some point, I'm going to want to editorialize about the 1st Cav in 1968. They were in the field the whole time.
Okay.
Every 6 weeks, we might do 3 weeks on an artillery base, guarding
right.
the perimeter. We took turns. So it was Creighton Abrams become the head of the 1st Cav sometime in late 67, early 68, and he broke them up. They were going in battalion size stuff out in the woods, and he switched them to companies and said, "You're staying out. You're staying out there. We're bringing the fight to the enemy," and that's what happened.
Mm-hmm. All right. Before we get into the actual unit and description of it and what took place from there, could you talk a little bit about LZ Sharon, what it looked like and kind of how it was organized, I guess?
Yeah, it was big, all dirt, a couple of Quonset huts, mostly big tents and some smaller tents, and it was always dusty because a couple of the first Cav aviation groups were there, and they were always landing and taking off. And there was, you know, there was medevacs were there, and they were always landing and taking off. And there were fire missions. The artillery was shooting. The battalion area was
several tents, ten tents perhaps of different sizes. Each battalion had a medical setup, and there were bunkers. First Sergeant and the Executive Officer was there, and, you know, some type, clerk typist types and stuff like that. And each battalion had its own cooks and mess, and primarily they fed the folks back there. Once in a while, they sent us a meal out in the field. It looked like it was ready for war, that LZ. It impressed me with that.
Okay. All right. How long were you there before moving out in the field?
Maybe one night. Maybe I went out the same day. I don't remember.
Okay. But
no time at all.
Sure. All right. And the was the company still, were they actively engaged in a fight, I guess, so to speak, when you showed up? Was the...
No, I showed up at about 5 o'clock at night, so that's why I'm thinking I went the same day. And they were just set up for the night, and to my knowledge, they didn't have any... No fighting went on that day, I don't think. It was stragglers, they were, you know, they were... And interested in getting some folks captured, too. They wanted to talk to some people, but... Mm-hmm. I don't think we got mortared that night. I don't think so.
Okay. Well, upon arrival, what was your first impression of the company? And you don't have to discuss specific names if you would prefer not to, but could you talk about, I guess, about some of the personalities you ran into there?
First one I ran into was the company commander, Colonel Peters. I don't remember his first name. He was a black man from Louisiana, and he was short. He was... I don't think he was with the company more than 6 weeks after I got with it. Mm-hmm. And I'll never forget him. I love Colonel Peters because he said, I'm going to send you boys home to your mamas alive. So I like that idea. He just gave us a little short talk, I'm sure. And then I went to the first platoon and talked to the sergeant. Sergeant Martinez was a hardcore dude, and, he was telling me what squad I was going to go to, and he said, they're all going to try to get you to carry the machine gun. They're all going to try to get you to walk point constantly, and country's going to want you to write letters home for him. And he said, Sergeant Martinez said, you're not going to carry the gun. Cox is going to carry it because he's the best at it, and you can write all the letters you want. That's okay with me. And we take turns walking point. He said, some people don't walk point because they're no good at it, but you'll get your crack at it. We'll see. Mm-hmm. And then he pulled something out of his fatigue pants, out of the cargo pockets, I guess they are. And it was a cellophane bag full of shriveled up black, well, they were black by now, ears.
Mm-hmm.
And he said, since Tet, he says, I got myself quite a few ears here. I didn't do this earlier in my tour, but I did it after Ted.
Mm-hmm.
Scared the shit out of me.
I was going to ask you what your reaction was.
Yeah, it was, yeah. Oh my God, type reaction.
Right.
I tried not to do it verbally to him, but I'm sure I looked like I mm-hmm. wanted to go somewhere else.
Mm-hmm.
And then he took me to the squad, and I'm kind of amazed by this, but I cannot remember the name of the squad leader. I can remember every other name, I think, in the squad. Maybe not then, but certainly when I was later squad leader and when I was spent the bulk of my time here. But I can't remember that guy's name.
Mm-hmm. Sure.
And who was there? There was Cox, the machine gunner from Connecticut. Duckett. Later immortalized because of his name. We can get to that later. He was from Tennessee.
Okay.
Cox and Duckett became my mentors. When you go to a squad, they generally give you someone to watch. For some reason, I had those two. Abel Amanderas from Texas. And Jack Fontenot from Louisiana. He was a Cajun from Eunice, Louisiana. He was just there a day or two. We spent our tour together, became as good a friends as you could.
Yes, sir.
And I don't remember any other names. Country was Country. I don't know what his name was.
Okay.
And bumped into Gordy Berg, my buddy from AIG. He was in the second platoon. I had joined the company with two other guys, and I remember one of their names if I see it. I've been in contact with a fellow who died over there, his daughter, and he was in the same squad as her. I just can't remember his name right now, but anyway, he went back to Vietnam with the daughter that did much later on, of course. So I'm in the first platoon, and in the first squad, and I settle in, and we start humping every day, and I don't remember the first time I got shot at. I don't remember the first time I got mortared, but we were in booby traps, extremely heavy for, it seemed like, a couple of weeks. I'm thinking that they set booby traps as they left. And he didn't care where they sent them because they weren't going to be there anymore, and they were everywhere.
Sir.
And of course, we walked single file. If we were in a field, we would send out flank. Every platoon would have a flank on each side, which was just one guy walking out there, maybe 50 yards. I don't know. It'd have to be a field to do that. When we were in the woods or in the jungle, it was single file.
Before getting into any more about life in the field at the moment, if we could, I want to ask you a few more questions about your arrival and about your impressions. Did you go through any of the new guy stuff? Did you receive any, I guess, negative treatment as a result of that?
None whatsoever.
Okay.
They even talked about, we don't do that.
Mm-hmm.
We don't. Seniority is only for discipline, and when we're in fights, everybody takes turn on guard. Everybody takes turn eating sea rations. You get the lousy ham and beans every 12th day, no matter, or every 12th meal, and the squad leader gets it also, and blah, blah, blah. It was good. They treated me very, very good.
Did it seem as if everyone in the unit got along pretty well?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, I'd say so. I didn't like Abel Amanderis, and he didn't like me, so we didn't talk much to one another, and that was that. And later on, I had a kid that I didn't get along with who was when I was squad leader, and that's probably it.
All right. Well, given that the company had just been through, I guess, the fighting with Tet and everything that had gone on, how was morale when you arrived?
My memory of morale is that it was always lousy. You know, I mean, if you paid any attention, got Time Magazine, mailed you, or anything like that, and you knew what was going on back in the States, then I don't know how morale could be very good. And we knew enough about other infantry outfits to know that they weren't out in the woods the whole damn time. And we didn't like that. And we got a bunch of young lieutenants who weren't very good, and that was bad for morale. Luckily, we had Martinez for 3 or 4 months before he... I don't know if he got killed or wounded, but anyway, before he left, I just never saw morale good in the... I can't imagine it being good in an infantry company in Vietnam, but that's just my experience.
Right.
It certainly was. Well, I'm not talking about mutiny or fragging anybody or anything
sure.
like that.
Yes, sir.
I'm just saying we didn't like where we were, and we thought we got a raw deal, and we certainly, without question, spent a lot of time grousing about the people who weren't out there that we called pokes or rear echelon MFers or
right.
stuff like that. You know,
right.
We definitely spent a lot of time talking about them and didn't like them.
Mm-hmm.
Still don't.
Yes, sir. All right. Well, I know you mentioned it. You said if you guys were knew anything about what was going on back at home, that would have a negative impact on morale. Did you guys have an idea, much of an idea, I guess, of the bigger picture and what was happening back at home? Did you know about it? Did you talk about it?
Yeah, I mean, we got magazines sent to us, some of us, and the bigger picture, I'm talking about protests and stuff like that.
Right, right.
Not the conduct of the war. I don't. Didn't have an opinion about that. Still don't. Well, yes, I do. We should have fought to win, but whatever. But anyway, I'm talking about the people our age having what appeared to be a real good time protesting the war. And,
and
of course, I don't know when the, you know, and I was a big reader of novels and stuff and mailers, you know, going on the Pentagon. People I respected were deadly against the war, and that personally made me feel kind of like an idiot.
Mm-hmm. All right.
But once you got there, once you made friends, or even right off the bat, there was no way to not fight the war, not do your job.
Yes,
at least I didn't know of any. You could get out of the field, maybe, by acting certain ways to act, and but if you were in the company, in the platoon, in the squad, you did your job, and you did it as good as you could.
Mm-hmm.
You had to, or you'd be killing people or killing yourself.
All right. Well, as far as I ask you about people getting along, did you ever see any problems with, say, racial tensions, anything like that? Was that ever an issue?
I'm thinking in the rear, maybe once in a while. I would say no in the company. I don't know if this tone was set because we had such a great CO who was black. There were some great platoon sergeants who were black. I actually think they were almost the backbone of the Army, black sergeants, but... We didn't joke around either about it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the neighborhood I came from had we called each other Polacks and Dagos and, mm-hmm. you know, stuff like that. And, but I don't know. I just never found it ever joked much between black folks and white folks.
Mm-hmm.
But, there was no racial tension in our company at all. I have a story about that if you want to hear it, however.
Sure, absolutely, if you don't mind.
Okay. The CAV was sent to the Quezon area. The CAV's opinion was to save the Marines, and the Marines' opinion was to get the glory because the Gooks were leaving anyway. But anyway,
right.
we went there. Maybe Operation Pegasus was the name of that. I'm not sure.
Okay.
And our company, Company A, 1st through 12th, was the first company at a place called, God, I can't believe I can't remember these names. It was a Special Forces Camp, Seven Clicks from...
Vang Lai?
Shit. You know what I'm talking about. They were overrun the night of Tet.
Right.
It's the first time they saw Vietnamese, North Vietnamese with helicopters.
Okay.
They also had tanks on that attack, and a great book was written about it later called The Night of the Silver Stars.
Mm-hmm.
That's a real good book about that. Anyway, okay. We were the first company there, and we were shocked that Americans were still laying around, you know, the bodies.
Mm-hmm.
It was 5 weeks since then. Oh, no, it was, well, I take that back. It was 3 months, let me think, 2 months since then, and there were dead GIs, and one of them was there was a black soldier in a Jeep as we walked in, we had to pass him, and there was a lower camp and a main camp, and at the first night or two we stayed at the lower camp. Anyway, an hour or two after we were there, big commotion, some of us run over, and someone had put a pencil, jabbed a pencil in the dead GI's eye.
Mm.
And it wasn't there when we got there, and it had to be it had to be one of us.
Right.
And That's in her's book, Hare, whatever his name is, the great book. Dispatches.
Dispatches, yeah. Okay.
That episode's in there. I talked to him personally, both before and after that. Mm-hmm. He was asking us, you know, was it, it had to be a white guy, right? And I said, well, I don't know. I guess. Anyway, you know, I guess that shows there was had to be some racial problems if that happened. Didn't make a big thing of it in the book. I don't think maybe a page about that. And the funny thing about it is, it in later editions of that book, he took out a couple of paragraphs about the pencil. But anyway, that there was that, and I remember about ready to leave, and I see Henry Allen from my squad, a black kid from New Mexico, you know, 20, 30 meters away or something, in this big throng. I don't know what we were doing. I bet we were standing around waiting to have our names read off, told and being told what flight we were on and stuff like that. And I saw him. I yelled, Al, and I stuck up my hand and made a fist. I guess black people call that the power salute. And I remember a couple of guys with him got real mad, and he calmed him down. He says, hey, you know, I don't know what he said. I shouldn't say. So I guess, you know, those fellas didn't like a white guy making that sign, even though it was a Union salute long before it was a power salute. You know, just little things like that. I guess I remember. I did something once that I'm sure somebody might be considered racial. I was back in the rear, just got off a chopper, armed, threw my pack on the ground. I'm carrying my M16 because I would never let it go out in the field. We're going through the chow line, and a tall, black staff sergeant gives me the Ludo servings you can imagine. I can't believe I did this. I stuck my weapon up alongside his temple and said, I want some more food. I doubt if that's how I said it. And nothing came of that. I should have ended up in jail, probably. But he was a, you know, African-American, so I guess I'm sure I would have done the same thing to a white guy, but
right.
Probably looked racial to onlookers who were black. I don't know.
When you just wanted more food, right?
Yes, I just definitely wanted more food. You know, and the idea that it was freshly cooked was quite attractive.
Sure.
Because when you get that food out in the field, which didn't happen very often, but it sat around and blah, blah, blah. You know, I'd much rather have eaten sea rashes than food transported out to the field.
Okay. All right. Well, one other issue about, things like similar to that, potential problems in the unit or whatever.
Yeah, sure.
Was there ever a drug problem in the unit? Did you ever see much of that in the unit?
I saw a medic one night in the first Cav training that I told you about when I first got there.
Mm-hmm.
A friend of mine from Basic I ran into there, and he says, let's go over here and smoke some marijuana. And I went along with him, and the MPs caught us.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think we lit up or anything. I don't remember. Anyway, we ended up in this room. I guess they talked to us, and they let us go, and the Marine, we got outside, got away from the Marines, showed us his heroin kit he had shoved down the back of his pants. That they didn't find, you know, they didn't search us, I don't think. That's the only time I knew of anybody doing heroin, although I guess it was, there was a lot of it in the rear. Marijuana was carried by us and smoked. I smoked marijuana when we got to those three-day camps. Never smoked it in the field, what we called the field. Believe me, people would have called those artillery bases the field. But infantrymen certainly didn't
mm-hmm.
consider them out in the field. So, you know, I smoked marijuana over there.
Mm-hmm.
Most sure. people I know did.
Right.
That's it. Nothing else.
Right. All right. Was the feeling that, you know, this is, you know, I've seen some negative criticism towards GIs for that, but was the feeling that this is what's going on in the world at the time, you know, back in the States, it's prevalent as well, you know.
Yeah.
Was that kind of the feeling that you guys had?
That and all the World War II movies you saw with the guys raiding wine cellars, and
right,
we didn't see any difference between that and marijuana. In fact, we'd get care packages with booze in them, and I would drink that in the field at night,
mm-hmm.
Which I would never have smoked marijuana.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know.
All right. Okay.
For instance, I never saw anything like the separation of the juice heads and the marijuana smokers like there was in Platoon.
Okay.
Everybody was... Yeah, I mean, I believe that the CO, I would be shocked if he didn't know some people were smoking marijuana on fire bases. I don't know. Maybe he didn't. Mm-hmm. He certainly knew they were drunk.
Right.
But
all right.
We had a company commander who, believe it or not, and I know this is true because I verified it with a guy, a good friend of mine, actually from Lubbock, Texas, Mike Kerr, who was in this first platoon, second squad, and we became great friends. Anyway, we were talking about that guy, and we called him Sergeant Case of Beer. Not Sergeant, he was a first lieutenant, but he was the company commander. And he humped a case of beer every day. They brought him a case of beer with the morning bird where they came and took away the mortars, and we didn't hump the mortars and the mortar plates and the weapon itself during the day. They brought him in at night. So they'd come and get that in the morning, and maybe there was mail, I don't know, I can't remember. He'd get his case of beer, strap it on his back, and off he went.
Mm-hmm.
So I doubt if he was too hard on us.
All right. Well, I guess if we could talk a little bit about, the daily routine or a normal day.
Easy enough. I guess we'd start when we'd wake up in the morning. We were, of course, in a circle. Think wagon trains and Indians. We were in a circle. There was four platoons in a first cab company in those days, and one was a mortar platoon. They were in the inside the circle along with the company commander and his group. Which maybe I should explain who that was. That would be a forward observer, who was usually a first or second lieutenant, who would call in artillery when we needed it.
Okay.
And there would be two or three RTOs, probably two. One he used to talk to the company, and the other one he used to talk to the battalion. You know, I think there was three. And then another one he probably talked to artillery and... if we called in airplanes. And the three non-mortar platoons were on the perimeter, squads together. That night we had set out trip flares and how could I forget the name of this? The thing that was command detonated that sent out the pellets.
Oh, the Claymores?
Yeah, Claymores. Okay. Greatest invention infantryman ever had. We'd set those and trip flares out every night. I don't know how long it took, but it was discovered that I was great at setting up trip flares and never set them off.
Mm-hmm.
So I always did that for the squad. A lot of guys had a hard time doing that. You would, two tent pegs, trip flare taped to a tent peg, and the wire would run from the trip flare to the other tent peg to set up this, gosh, I don't know how long it was, 10-meter wire for the enemy to trip if they got close to us.
Okay.
And the Claymores were right outside of that. They were farther out. Most of the time we dug fighting positions and sleeping positions. I should amend that. Early on we did that.
Okay.
We did that up in the I Corps where we spent, vis-a-vis my tour, we spent from February to October in I Corps before we went down south.
We'd get up and cook ourselves some sea rations or eat them cold, whatever we liked. And squad leaders would go talk to the platoon sergeant and the platoon leader. After the platoon leader and platoon sergeant came back from talking to the CO, and they'd find out a little bit about what we were going to do that day. Sometimes, maybe, oh gosh, 3 or 4 dozen times during my year there, we would go on choppers and go to another location, maybe make a hot landing, meaning they were shooting at us when we landing and shooting mortars at us. Mm-hmm. The other time we would walk the entire day. Of course, we walked after we made our helicopter landing, so we walked all the time. And we knew the order because the order was a thing that rotated, and we knew platoons would take turns being point platoons. Every third day, the point platoon would be yours, and every third day that your platoon had it, your squad would have point. So I guess that means every ninth day you'd have point, which was no fun. And you'd move out after you ate and after you sat around a while. Maybe if they got mail, they'd give you 15 more minutes to sit around, and then we'd take off for the day and basically walk until we were fired upon or hit a booby trap, and stop around noon and eat some more sea rations. Of course, you're carrying all this stuff. Then you'd take off again, and I'm guessing we had smoke breaks. I know we had smoke breaks, you know, during that time. And depending on how close you were to your objective for the night, you might stop as early as 4, and you might have to walk into the dark some nights, which was not good because it was no fun sitting up at night and digging in the dark and bringing in a chopper in the dark, and that kind of stuff was no fun. Guard was a squad by squad thing. You all had to do it, and depending on how many people you had, it was generally an hour or so, and you just got in a fighting position and looked out and, you know, tried to see if anybody was coming. You didn't want to stare at a tree or a bush or something, because that son of a gun's going to move if you're staring at it long enough. So you try to keep your eyes moving. Seems like we passed a watch, where even though, you know, a lot of us had watches, we passed a watch, and actual wristwatch. And when your hour was up, you went and got your man. You had to know how the order of how they were sleeping so you could wake up the right guy. And then you'd wake him up, you'd go back to guard, you know, and once in a while you'd have to go wake him up again. But anyway, generally speaking, you didn't want to leave that position empty for more than a few seconds, I guess, a minute. You know, it's the line was manned by, instead of 3 squads in a platoon, it'd be manned by 2, because of the 3 non-mortar platoons they sent out an ambush every night. We called them ambush. I think they were more accurately described as a listening post.
Okay.
So every third night you had that, your squad. And they could get hairy, that's for sure. But anyway, you'd go out a designated distance. Oftentimes, as you were coming in to your night position, the company would stop, and one of the platoons would find out that's where they wanted them to go that night. Couldn't do it for everybody because you're walking on a straight line and you're not on the other points of the compass. So at least one of the squads might find out where they were going to be that night, and you'd wait till dusk and go out there. I guess that's a normal day. I didn't tell you much about the helicopters, but one would come generally in the morning, get the mortar stuff, and one would come at night with whatever was requested during the day and the mortar stuff. I don't know how often they brought us
sea rations. But I know we carried more than one day sea ration, that's for sure. And mail, hopefully. Care packages, the like. Maybe some new guys. Maybe some old guys coming back from being wounded or R&R. Maybe the first sergeant coming out to get his CIB, the asshole. You know, that kind of stuff. Generally speaking, the first sergeant and the executive officer didn't go out in the field. But if they're in an infantry company, they want the CIB. And to, in order to get the CIB, you had to go through infantry training and be a certain amount of time in an infantry company or be a ranger, they can get them too. So I don't know when they came out, but it didn't seem like they were out there much. But one of our favorite pastimes in jest was ruminating on fragging the first sergeant. We talked about it a lot. And I got to admit, at times I didn't know who was serious and who's not. And now I say we weren't any of us serious, but who knows. Anyway, it didn't happen. So that's good. We didn't like our first sergeant too much. We expected to, if we were to land in the rear because of transit to R&R or coming back from being wounded or some other scam we might have thought up, that we would be left alone. But he had other ideas, you know, details. Wanted us to do stuff, so we didn't like that. Anyway, I you know, that's a normal day without any fighting. Or without any booby traps.
With the first sergeant, was there a lot of focus on things like I don't know, army decorum, like you know your hat's not on right or your uniform is not you know not the way he wants it to be? Was there was that one of the things that he did as well? Or?
No, I don't think so. I don't think we had any of that at all. I mean, I suppose if a guy came back there out of the field and we were absolutely filthy. You know, we'd spend as long as 2 months in the field without a bath, maybe longer, although we would bathe in streams if the opportunity arose. And it didn't very often. I suppose if a guy went back there for 2 days and the first sergeant seen he hadn't taken a shower, he might yell at him. I also can't imagine anybody doing that. But no, I don't think he, because to get, we'd go, okay, let's just say we'd go back there in filthy clothes and we'd take a shower, and there'd be a pile of uniforms there, and we'd put them on. And it'd have someone else's name. That's all, though. There'd be no rank or unit designation. But, I mean, we'd just grab these uniforms and hope that they fit. And all we wore was shirt, pants, and shoes. We wore no socks. A few guys wore T-shirts, though, I remember. But basically speaking, we didn't wear socks, and my feet were green for several years. It was more that the first sergeant would say, well, you've heard the expression burn the shit, right? Burn the shit house?
Yeah, yes, sir.
Okay, so that was a half of a 50 can, five, or maybe a, yeah, half of a 55 gallon barrel underneath an outhouse or underneath a row of outhouse. You'd pull them out with a hook, pour some God knows what on it and light it. Probably jet fuel or something. Anyway, that was burning the shit house. Well, nobody wanted to do that. Probably KP. I mean, I don't know. Someone had to wash the cooking utensils and stuff.
Right. Yes, sir.
I certainly don't remember ever doing KP in Vietnam, but somebody had to do it. Stuff like that. Maybe a run to the dump, which was kind of fun. You know, get out, they'd have a Jeep or something pull a trailer full of stuff that you'd have to take to the dump and jump out and watch the kids scavenge through it. That was kind of fun. Stuff like that.
Okay. All right.
So. But I'll tell you what. In my experience, an infantryman who's gone through what they've gone through and then gone back to the rear is in no mood for any crap from anybody.
Right. I know you you mentioned a little bit earlier that that you guys weren't too fond of the rimps of the rear echelon guy. Was that part of the reason why? Because you come back and it's all this other
It's part of the reason why. The other part is, well, you know, the
one for 10, one for 8 ratio of infantrymen to everybody else.
Right.
We didn't particularly care for that, and we certainly didn't see that we were getting that kind of support.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I'm not knocking the artillery and the Air Force that support us, because they, you know, they saved us a couple of times. But, you know, it was a healthy dose of jealousy on our part, and just, oh, you know, what did we ever do to deserve this, I guess? I don't know. But, I mean, that was a main topic of conversation, how we hated them.
Right.
You know, just a couple hours a day we could talk.
Mm-hmm.
And there was always stories coming back from R&R and ending up in a Air Force mess hall.
Mm-hmm.
And it was like, you know, better than they ate at home.
Right.
That kind of stuff. And I've heard Marines, I've heard other people talk about the difference. Cold chocolate milk. Everybody was very mad about that.
Sure.
You know, they're drinking cold chocolate milk 3 times a day and stuff like that.
Right.
I have a story about cold chocolate milk. Early on, the evening bird comes in. I'm designated to go get the mail and whatever's. And I think they said they got cold chocolate milk. So as I'm walking back and balancing 8 pints or half pints, whatever those little things are, half pints, I opened one up and poured it in my mouth, and it immediately geyser like throw it out because it's as sour as it could possibly be. Freezing cold.
Right.
Freezing cold, but sour. Somehow I can't see the Air Force or most pogues drinking sour chocolate milk.
Right. Yes, sir.
But,
huh. All
right. But, you know, the pogue thing is 80% jealousy, I'm sure. You know, because there were jobs in the rear for infantrymen to get out of the field, and a good way to get it was to extend.
Mm-hmm.
Which, I don't know, that doesn't make much sense for me. If you get somebody to extend it and he doesn't stay out in the field, but anyway, I had Gordy Berg, my buddy that I told you about from AIT, who was from Rock Island, Illinois, did that. He had to stay in 3 more months to be able to exit the Army upon leaving Vietnam, and he did stuff around there. He was a buck sergeant like I was, so he didn't, you know, he didn't burn the shit and stuff, but
mm-hmm.
he had some job back there.
Right. You mentioned, I guess, a feeling of jealousy of somewhat, but on your part, on the part of the guys in the field, was it also, from your perspective, a thing of pride as well, that you guys are out there doing the real work, so to speak, while they're, you know, in the rear screwing off or whatever?
Yeah. You know, it's probably more so now than it was then, but
yeah.
It certainly was then, too.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know. I think there might be a better feeling than pride, but I just can't come up with it right
okay.
now. Yeah. You know, it depends on the circumstances. Like, I grew up with a group of guys where I was the youngest and the least toughest, and I hung around with some pretty tough characters. And
mm-hmm.
and I always thought to myself, well, what would they have been like over here? Because I did okay.
Mm-hmm.
And so I guess that's pride. I don't know what else it'd be.
Mm-hmm. All right. Okay. Well, since you mentioned things like the chocolate milk and things like that, what about could you talk a little bit more about the food? I guess the sea rations and
yeah.
that type of thing.
Yeah, some of it was horrible. Well, let me just describe the pack. They came in a box. A case, I guess we called them, of 12 sea ration boxes inside that. And when they'd bring them off the chopper, we'd have to break that down. That was a big ceremony we'd have, because you'd be carrying, like I said, I don't remember how many meals, maybe 6 meals you'd be carrying. The boxes were like 6x4, the ones with the individual meals. They made the 4 inside made a great postcard.
Okay.
And since you didn't need stamps, you could just tear that up and write a postcard home and give it to whoever's got the mail going, and, you know, saying I'm okay and we're here and blah blah blah.
Mm-hmm.
But each package, each box, the little boxes contained the main meal,
of which there were, I guess, 12 different kinds. There was no repeats in the case. Ham and beans.
Right.
The most famous one was not edible. Mm. You know what they were called, right?
Yeah, him and mother. You know,
yes.
Yeah.
I don't know if we're cussing any more than I have already, but that was a very descriptive nickname. We
right.
hated those things. But everything else in that box was okay.
Uh-huh.
And, you know, they should have had peaches and pound cake in that box, but I don't know if they did or not.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, there was ham and beans, beans and franks, spaghetti and meatballs,
mm-hmm.
A couple of egg things, turkey loaf, probably the best meal there was, turkey loaf.
Okay.
For me, I can only speak for me, obviously.
Right.
Anyway, there's 12 of these different kinds. Spiced beef was pretty bad. Ham, something or other. And with that main can, that can is the size of a can you'd buy beans in at the store or corn. You know what I mean? That size
okay.
can.
Right.
4 inches high, I guess it is, whatever it is. And along with that, there'd either be in a can a hunk of bread or date bread or crackers.
Okay.
And some kind of jam, usually in a can. Everything's in a can, except there were those. There was a pack of cigarettes with four in it.
Mm-hmm.
The kind of cigarettes they used to give out when I was a kid for samples, I remember. That's, you know, something they wouldn't dare do now. But anyway,
right.
there were cigarettes, matches, salt and pepper, sugar, the main meal, the bread and crackers, and I think always a can of fruit.
Mm-hmm.
They were all good. There was pears, fruit cocktail, peaches, and the delicacy of all delicacies was in one of those cans, there was a pound cake, and if you mixed it with peaches, I'm sure you've had people talk about that. And there might have been two of those in a case, I don't know. But,
okay.
And I'm sure in the day I knew what they came with, but I can't remember now.
Sure.
So I probably, I might have smoked those four cigarettes a day, but I certainly didn't smoke 12 a day. I don't know what. I suppose I gave them to somebody. Mm-hmm. I don't know. And at the end of my tour, I went without eating the main meal, probably 8 out of the 12 times. I just couldn't eat them anymore.
Mm-hmm.
I was still eating beans and franks and turkey loaf and a couple others, but couldn't handle it. Like I said, we'd probably get like 3 cases per squad or something, and squad leader would say, all right, what's the order we're going in? And we'd go in an order, and we'd get our food, and nobody bullied anybody. You just took turns getting the bad ones and the good ones. You know what? I can't really remember eating 3 of those a day. I'm not sure. Of course, that was probably an individual thing. If you wanted to eat 3 of them a day, you had the time to do it because we'd stop for a half-hour lunch.
Mm-hmm.
But we certainly wouldn't heat anything at lunchtime.
Okay.
And how we heated this stuff was we made a little stove out of the crackers or bread cans. They were probably a third the size of the can the main meal came in. And you take a can opener, the church key kind, if you know what I mean, and you'd
yes.
poke 4 or 6 holes around the side of it, and you'd pinch off a quarter size, the coin quarter size pinch of C4, the plastic explosion,
okay.
and you'd heat it with that. It was intense heat, and, you know, you had to stir it, and a lot of guys burned it when I first learned how to do that. And a lot of the stuff I never heated ham loaf or turkey loaf. And a lot of the times you didn't heat it because you were lucky to be getting a meal and you were looking for the enemy.
Right.
Taking fire from the enemy, probably. But anyway, that's the sea rations.
Okay.
The opener for the cans is one of the greatest inventions of all time, called a P-38. I used one for years afterwards. There was no better way to open a can than that thing. It was a little device that you just... you know, ratcheted around the can, and it came right off the top.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, there was also a plastic knife, spoon, and fork.
Okay. All right. Well, while we're on the subject, I guess, things about food and kind of life in the field, how difficult was it for you, I guess, to get any sleep at night? Was that a pretty difficult thing?
Yeah. Although I think as we went on, we probably learned to sleep through some stuff.
Mm-hmm.
At first, I assume it was hard for me. I'm sure it was hard for me to fall asleep.
Uh-huh.
All the new things that were whirling through my mind that I had experienced during that day, and you know, like sometimes if you had guard from 4 to 5, you didn't even bother to go back and lay on your air mattress. We carried air mattresses that we blew up every night.
Okay.
Laid on them, and generally, if we needed it, we covered ourselves with a puncho liner. It's kind of a space-age blanket that was supposed to be used in conjunction with the puncho itself, and I never saw it used that way. It was just used as a blanket. You know, you could come back from guard and not be able to fall asleep and things like that. And most people, you know, guard was, I suppose, started at 8, maybe 9, I can't remember. And if you had guard at 11, you might not bother to turn in till midnight, stuff like that. No, I suppose 5 hours of sleep would have been a healthy night's sleep.
Okay.
That kind of thing. And there was never time for sleep anytime else. And I remember sleepless nights, for sure. And when you went out on every third day when you had a listening post, there wasn't much chance of more than a couple hours of sleep.
All right. Okay. How about other things in the field, like, I don't know, were insects, animals, things like that ever a problem?
Mosquitoes were a constant problem, and leeches were pretty close to being a common problem. The leeches were... did you ever see The African Queen, the movie?
No, sir.
Okay, well, Humphrey Bogart comes out of the water after repairing the propeller on his boat, and he's covered with big black leeches,
mm-hmm.
almost 3 inches long and an inch and a half wide. That's not what these things were. These things were more the size of like a wasp or something.
Okay.
They were maybe an inch and a half long and just skinny insects that were on the grounds and bushes and trees, and if they got on you, they'd find a vein or something and bite you and suck the blood out. And they got in some nasty places.
Mm-hmm.
We got them off with lit cigarette embers and mosquito repellent.
Okay.
I don't think mosquito repellent kept them off of you, but you could get them off. You'd spray them and they'd fall off. Ticks were bad. They were... I had a tick that bit me underneath my left armpit on the main vein there, and a big mole grew.
Mm.
And so I don't know what that's all about. But anyway, there were ticks too. There were a lot of bees, actually. We called them sweat bees because they'd fly around us and we'd swat them. And mosquitoes were always present. They were terrible. I had malaria. I don't know how many people had malaria. That's another story into itself, is the famous malaria pills. Before I tell you about animals and snakes,
sure.
We were supposed to take them every day and a bigger one on Sunday, or once a week.
Okay.
And when I first got there, I was seeing medic, doc, would hand them the pill for the day, and they'd drop them. And I didn't understand it, because I was taking them.
Right.
And I asked them. They said, well, here's the tough story. They don't prevent you from getting malaria. The malaria will be in your bloodstream, but you won't have symptoms until you quit taking the pills.
Hmm.
So they'll get their year out of you, and you'll go home and have the symptoms of malaria when you quit taking the pills. So I never took them again, and I got malaria and got highly chewed out by the full bird colonel in the hospital, because I was showing the symptoms of malaria, and he wanted to know why, and I told him. He got madder still, but anyway. That was the story on the malaria pills. A lot of monkeys, especially when we got down on the Cambodian border, flying around the trees. Deer, we'd see deer. Snakes, less than I anticipated. I'm not a snake lover. Mm-hmm. And exotic spiders. Sometimes you'd walk through some nasty webs that you didn't see and things like that. Well, I don't know any other way to say this, but the famous fuck you lizard, I'm sure you've heard of.
Right.
I mean, they sounded exactly like they was crying then. They were iguana-like creatures, I guess, and they only made that noise at night.
Right.
That's when I was kind of an atheist then, but I decided, well, if there's got to be a God who's got a sense of humor. If there's like a lizard screaming that at us.
Right. Yes, sir. All right. What about, I don't know, I guess if you talk about, what types of things did you carry in the field?
Well, let's just talk about me. I carried 40 magazines for my M16. I always humped the M16 and fired it. I always carry at least 100 rounds of M60 Pancho Villa style around, you know, linked around my body.
Okay.
And it, depending on the guess as to the, how bad this stuff was going to be and how much there was a chance of us getting attacked, I might carry 300 wrapped around my two crossed over my chest and one around my waist. One Claymore, one trip flare. Four hand grenades. If I used one during the day, I wouldn't replace it right away. So I might get down to three or two. I think we'd all carry a smoke grenade, so we'd have a good supply of that. We used smoke grenades always to let the choppers know where we were.
Okay.
We sometimes used them to mask our a movement in the field from the enemy. Sea rations. We carried several meals of sea rations. Ammunition. Hopefully we'd have some food left over from a care package we'd be humping. A law, light anti-tank weapon. We'd have several in the squad, so we'd probably take turns carrying those. I started out with a regular GI pack, and I whittled my way down to just having my sleeping gear wrapped around some things on my back and sea rations in my pockets of both my shirt and pants. The 40 magazines were in bandoliers. They came in cloth bandoliers.
Okay.
So I had a whole bunch of those wrapped around me. When I hit the ground, I generally bruised myself with sea rations, but I didn't like the pack. I got to where I wouldn't carry that. Most guys did. The guys I felt sorry for were the radio operators that had to carry the radio and food, writing material, toothbrushes, toothpaste, stuff like that. They didn't carry any. They probably carried one bandolier of 40. They always carried the M16, but they didn't carry. Probably didn't carry grenades, or certainly not trip flares or claymores, or 60 ammo. They didn't carry that stuff. Still, the radio weighed a lot, probably 25 pounds or so. We carried a lot. And the individual stuff, you know, writing material in a billfold, generally wrapped in plastic, since our chances of getting wet were pretty good. Crossing streams or rivers or getting rained on. We didn't, from February to February of 68 to 69, we didn't experience the monsoon very much, and I always wondered why, so I decided to look it up, and I wondered if it was a thing where we missed it when we went south, and I found out that was a year of almost a drought in Vietnam. And by our standards, it wouldn't have been a drought at all, but there was really no monsoon. We did go through a week of a typhoon that was unbelievable.
Oh, really?
Never experienced anything like it. You know, 40-mile-an-hour winds to 60-mile-an-hour winds and constant rain for a week. Never set up a... We just sat on the ground when it was time to go to sleep. We didn't even bother to blow up an air mattress. It was terrible. Mm-hmm. And we got mortared almost every night. And a couple of our ambushes were attacked. It was terrible. Guy died in my lap. The last night Typhoon struck from a... Opened up his... Didn't know him. Don't know his name to this day. I bet I could figure it out because I have a list of who died, which I got, you know, in the months during the time I was there because I was going to the wall and I wanted to have that. I got it from the 1st Cab Division Association. You know what? I don't even remember what your question was.
No, just general things about life in the field and what you were carrying, that type
of
thing.
Yeah, okay. Well, I pretty much told you what we carried.
Yes, sir.
I went about 3 or 4 weeks without a toothbrush one time because I used it to clean my weapon, somehow lost the one that I was using to clean my weapon, so that was bad. A lot of guys carried big knives, Bowie knives, knives from home. I didn't have a knife. I didn't carry one.
Mm-hmm.
And some guys wore gloves, and we used a machete on point sometimes when we needed it to chop through stuff. And I didn't wear gloves, and I ended up out in the field for 3 days with terrible jungle rot from the elephant grass cutting us up, and it gets infected. We didn't really cut our way through elephant grass, which was about 8 foot high probably, but it was sharp. The edges were sharp and they'd cut you up. That's why most of us left our sleeves all the way down. But we cut our way through vines. We call them wait-a-minute vines.
Okay.
If we were in the jungle or what we call the woods, let's say,
right,
there'd be those rather than elephant grass. I can't think of carrying anything else.
Okay. I know you said a little earlier, you talked about after a while you had basically whittled it down to the essentials, what you needed. What type of things would you discard and get rid of that they gave you when you first got there?
Okay, well, I forgot something that we carried, all of us, and that's an entrenching tool, which is a little shovel with a spade part of it folded back into the wood handle. We all carried that. Basically, it was just the pack.
Okay.
The pack and the frame.
Right.
Some guys carried NVA packs, which I probably should have done, except I had a rule that I never took anything from them. I didn't want anything they had. They were littler, and they would have been good for sea rations and stuff.
Okay.
But gas masks, I think it must have been, the first sergeant must have said, no one's got a gas mask out there. You don't want to take that. There's always the famous scene in literature and movies where the platoon sergeant goes through your pack and tells you to throw this stuff out.
Right.
And I think Martinez probably did that, but I think I was traveling light from the get-go.
Mm-hmm.
I was worried about carrying ordnance and stuff.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I didn't have the package with the pictures of people from home and stuff. I don't think I had any pictures.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of guys had that and took up a room and stuff. So for me, it was just the pack. It caught on stuff. It didn't feel good on me. And guys couldn't believe I did because they couldn't believe I was landing on my sea rations all the time. But I liked it better than the pack.
Mm-hmm.
And other than the gas mask, I don't know what we threw away.
Okay.
Oh. Probably nothing.
Right.
You know, well, wait a minute. That's not true. Gosh, how can I not think of the name of it? Of course, call it a bulletproof vest, but that's not what the Army called it.
Okay, I know what you're referring to.
Yeah,
I can't think
the sleeveless, canvas vest with something to stop shrapnel in it.
Yeah.
I don't think it stopped rounds, but
flak jacket.
Yeah, flak jacket.
Okay.
I've got buddies in the Marine Corps. I still find it hard to believe they say they wore it every day of their tour. They didn't want it, but they had to. Kind of similar to where we couldn't take our boots off at night. If we did and got caught, it was in Article 15. And which meant you lost some pay or something probably. But anyway, I'm kind of a pansy about running on bare feet on on the earth, so I didn't mind that. So once a day, you generally take them off and air your feet out. And that was almost always when we stopped for the night.
All right. Now, when you guys had had a little free time, if you did have much free time at all, how would you spend it? What did you guys do to entertain yourself?
Yeah, we had free time from the time we stopped at night till we went to bed, except that we had to dig and, you know, if we went out on ambush, I wouldn't call that free time because we were silent. But anyway, it would be spent reading and writing letters, mm-hmm. reading books, and just talking. Mm-hmm. Talking about how much we hate officers and pogues. That sort of thing. But talking about cars and women and uh-huh. stuff like that. Right. And we had a couple very experienced California kids who would talk about dope and stuff like that.
Right.
Rock and roll. Talk about rock and roll. And people carried radios. You could pick up Armed Forces Radio. And when we were in I-Corps, we got had O'Hanna all the time. She played much better music.
I've heard that. Right.
Oh, yeah. Much better.
Right.
And you didn't have to listen to the Clean Your Rifle stuff, which we did every night also.
Do you remember, like they had a, do you remember any of her propaganda? You remember?
I just remember her saying, drop your weapon and come over to our side. Mm-hmm. Soldier boy. I don't remember anything else. I'm thinking we were hooting and hollering and not listening to her.
Right.
Except when she played music.
Sure.
I don't think there was much of that. I think they played music a lot.
All right. Okay. I guess changing the subject a little bit, when you guys would be out on a patrol, helping in the field, how often would you say you would come into contact with the enemy?
You know what? I got to take a break right now.
Sure.
I'll be right back.
Yes,
I got to go to the bathroom.
Not
Hold
a
on.
Problem.
Hello?
Yes, sir.
Okay. All right. Let me let my dog out. Go
okay.
ahead. The amount of times we had contact. Okay. Well, I would separate it into two kinds of contact. Ambush, we would always call what happened during the day when we were walking, and then at night, which was usually mortars and rockets rather than a attack by soldiers. They were kept some distance between us, and they also knew by the time they set off the third mortar round, we would probably have an artillery round headed their way, unless one of the first two mortar rounds hit the foreign observer. Gosh, I never thought about this before. How many times? Well, if I averaged the whole year, it would certainly be once or twice a week.
Okay.
It would depend on the times, like when we went into the Quezon area, we had contact every day. The worst thing was the Aishaw Valley. I'm sure you've had people talk about the Aishaw Valley.
Mm-hmm. Yes,
that was constant.
Right.
And I don't know how long we were there, 3 weeks maybe. But when I joined the company up in I-Corps and the enemy was fleeing across the DMZ, I bet I went 2 weeks without getting shot at the first 2 weeks.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
But there were deaths and casualties from booby traps during that time. But anyway, generally, I'll say once a week, but when we went down to the Cambodian border, it was 3 or 4 times a week. In October, we went down there. Generally, during the day, we'd be walking, and almost exclusively, we'd be attacked at the front of the column.
Okay.
Which I always thought was stupid. I don't know why they didn't change that up. But anyway, it would be, 5 or less VC or probably NVA set up to by a trail, or else they saw us coming and they'd form up anticipating which way we'd go, and they just start firing at us, generally speaking. It's usually AK-47s. Mm-hmm. I was wounded because they had a M79 grenade launcher. Mm-hmm. You know, ambush we went into, which was kind of interesting. We were on point, and we crossed the stream, and we were walking up a hill, and the point man was unbelievably great at his job. He was our squad. He was a good, wonderful man. He was a Choctaw Indian from Red Oak, Oklahoma.
Okay.
Yeah, he was great. And anyway, he was walking up this hill, and I'm like three guys back. And he locks his heels and starts just falling backwards, and he's got his M16 on rock and roll, firing off a burst. And we start taking fire from several AKs and the stupid grenade launcher they got, and three or four of us got wounded. But anyway, when it's all done, we walk up where Mackie is, the point man, and he's shot in the face. A guy in a bunker, mm-hmm. who he had somehow seen his eyes or something.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, I'd have walked up to the thing and a guy could have, you know, cut me. But anyway, he was unbelievable.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I'll stick with once a week and at night mortared. Oh, man.
Right.
Maybe 50 times in a year.
Okay.
I don't know. Yeah, I you know, that was more harassment than anything. Not that they didn't hurt people, but I got a little story about one of those if you want to hear it.
Sure.
Our squad was out on listening post, and I was squad leader at the time, and we were behind a big felled tree, so we were behind a log, I guess we'll call it, but it was big, and I said, and there was it was a fork in a trail, and there were two trails going off the main trail, the trail we had taken down from the company. And I put a claymore down each one, gave Jack Fontenot one of the detonators, and I took the other one, and we settled in. And not very much longer, not hardly in the dark at all, they start mortaring our company, and we can see the flash of the mortar tube. So it's maybe 40 meters from us or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
So we start firing on the mortar round, and then we start taking fire from two different locations, basically down those trails like they had set up ambushes or something.
Mm-hmm.
So we set off both claymores, and that was it. There was never another sound from the three. I thought there was three locations. Maybe there was just two. Maybe one of the AK groups firing us were at the mortar pit, we'll call it.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, that's it for the night. We don't hear another peep. We don't hear moaning. We don't hear anything.
Right.
We don't get hit. None of us got hit. And Jack and I, Fontenot, go down both trails that morning. And down the trail to the left, laying on the trail, are two beautiful AK-47s.
Mm-hmm.
No blood to be seen. You know, when we would get wounds like weapons like that, there'd be blood everywhere. You know, they don't give those babies up.
Right.
So there were two AK-47s. So I'd never fired on a mortar squad before, and I certainly never got two pristine M47s like that, AK-47s like that before. So it was amazing.
Right.
I took them back, threw them at the feet of the company commander, and says, why don't you send these home to your wife? I was mad because we'd gotten a little argument on the radio that night. But anyway, that was my little mortar story, enemy mortar story.
Mm-hmm. Oh.
So it was mostly mortared at night, once in a while a ground probe, and being ambushed during the day. That's what it was.
Okay.
And some of the ambushes were particularly nasty because they had the site set up for mortar hits and AK-47s.
Mm-hmm.
I don't mean that. Rocket-propelled rifles or whatever they are. RPGs.
Right, okay.
Yeah, and, you know, those were very accurate. They shoulder-mounted, and hell, they can take down choppers with them.
Mm-hmm.
But that was bad. Although the most we ever lost in one ambush And I don't mean my squad. It was 10 guys were killed by our own helicopters. I think they all got it by the rockets they shoot. And if, thankfully, the four reserve died also, so we didn't have to live with that. That was probably the worst fight I was in as far as how many people were killed in one period.
Right.
But that's why you didn't want to walk point. You didn't want to walk point. Your squad didn't want to be a point squad because that's where it was going to be. That's where they always hit you.
Did you yourself walk point very
well? I did. As the time wore on in our squad, the point men were probably Mackey, Fontenot, and me, and somebody else, and I don't remember who. Yeah, for some reason, I was decent at it. I one time stopped, because I was, you know, Omaha is not New York, but it's a city, and, you know, I was a city boy. I wasn't a country boy. Mm-hmm. Anyway, I stopped once a foot from a wire to a 250-pound bomb they had ribbed.
Oh, wow.
I don't know why I saw it. But anyway, we stopped and backed up. You know, Mackey would have seen it from 10 feet probably. But I got lucky. That would have made a bang event. That was the main bomb our planes would drop, the 250-pound, not except for the B-52s.
Okay.
Which dropped big bombs.
Yes, sir. Well, we're coming up on 2 hours. You want to go ahead and take a break for today?
Yeah. You think you want to talk some more?
Absolutely.
Okay. Yeah, it sounds good to me.
All right.
Shall I go look at the calendar? You want to set the next time?
Yeah, we can do that. This is Jason Stewart with the Vietnam Archive at Texas Tech University, continuing an oral history interview with Mr. Ray Curran. Today is November 29, 2010, and this is interview session number 2. Okay, I'd like to start off today, if we could, by talking a little bit about your impressions of the enemy. Could you talk a little bit about your thoughts of them and, I guess, their capabilities?
I got to Vietnam a couple of days or a week and a half after the famous Tet of 68, mm-hmm. which probably did a good job of decimating the VC, so I pretty much fought NVA most of the time.
Okay.
Even though they were a regular enemy with uniforms and strict, I'm sure, order of chain of command and that sort of thing, they still had to live in the jungle and still were poorly fed, I'm sure, and not armed as well as they could have been and things like that, but they were a fierce enemy. I would never say anything about their skills to fight a guerrilla war or a jungle war might be a better word than guerrilla war. I don't know much about the guerrilla war tactics they used. Because I think of that as meaning targeting civilian populations and stuff like that. Not,
right.
My company was, for the year I was there, was almost entirely away from towns and villages, so I don't know much about that. But they were, first of all, they had a better weapon than we did, the basic infantry weapon. Their AK-47 was, I think, much better than ours. The only drawback might be that it was somewhat heavier. They were just good soldiers. They did more with less, that's for sure. And when we engaged them, there was usually 100 of us walking in single file. And even if we had a hell of a day, we might find a body or two.
Mm-hmm.
Which, of course, they supposedly took their bodies away. But what my point is that they seldom attacked us with great numbers or more than half a dozen people, probably. Now, at night, sometimes that was different. Or there might be more because they knew they could get away. Although they weren't. I was lucky enough to be in the first cab, and we had massive retaliation possibilities and with all our helicopters and stuff. But,
yes, sir.
Like I said, I don't know. I couldn't say anything bad about them. They were great soldiers.
Okay. All right. Could you talk a little bit about, well, how would they use, say, for example, the jungle and the terrain to their advantage? How did they do that? Could you talk a little about that?
Well, I would say they were great at hiding, camouflaging themselves, bunker systems were unbelievable, and it seemed like they would hit you at 3 o'clock in the afternoon when you were tired rather than 8 o'clock in the morning when you had, you know, just been out there for an hour or so on your march, walking down the trails or walking across fields or fighting the jungle at any rate. I don't think I saw too many of the homemade booby traps or whatever you would call them that I know other people saw. I saw a few sharpened sticks and bamboo in holes.
Mm-hmm.
I saw that. Punchy pits, I guess they called them.
Yes,
but there were other traps that I was aware of that I never saw, things that you might trip a wire and some kind of contraption would come out of a tree and do it. I never saw any of that. But, you know, they were excellent in camouflage and using the jungle to their advantage, although many of these people were probably from good-sized cities in North Vietnam. So I imagine they had to learn their stuff just like we had to learn ours. Their uniforms were hard. They were just the color of dry dirt. I mean, they were hard to see.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm sure ours were too. And ours were, you would get dirty very fast anyway. So,
right. So
there was that. Gosh. I don't know. I guess you could say the night was theirs. We didn't move at night very often. We didn't. Just some small groups of us would. And
okay.
I think they did most of their moving at night, I would guess. Because of helicopters.
Mm-hmm. Yes, sir.
I don't have much more to say, but I have infinite respect for them.
All right. Did you ever run into any of the tunnel systems? Did you ever come across any of that?
Yeah. Nothing like the famous ones around Chu Chi or you know, close to Saigon or close to big cities, but one afternoon, we got picked up by helicopters and taken to a field, left off, and we were met by great resistance, more than usual, a couple of 50 calibers and a lot of AK fire. And anyway, the helicopters and us won the day, and we got to looking around, and we were on top of what turned out to be a hospital complex, which was underground. So
right.
We saw that in there. There were a lot of dead women around, which, you know, was unusual. And the few villages we did go into, there was usually tunnels.
Okay. Yes, sir.
A friend of mine died in the tunnel on the China Sea in a fishing village that we thought was pretty pacified and mild, but he went in there, and there was probably a VC, I would think, there, and he got killed.
Yes, sir. You mentioned not seeing too many of the homemade type booby traps. Were they primarily using, would there be a lot of mines and things like bouncing Bettys, things like that, or?
Yeah, the most I saw of booby traps was after Tet, when we were blocking and chasing the NVA in their attempt to get back across the DMZ. I'm thinking they were setting them as they fleed, weren't concerned about their own people getting in them. The end of the group would be setting them, and they were pretty much standard issue Soviet and Chinese booby traps, probably, or mines, I should say. I guess booby trap would kind of indicate the name that it's pretty much homemade. They used our, now they were homemade to the extent that they would use our unexploded ordnance for booby traps and stuff like that. I once stopped a foot away from a wire that was hooked up to an unexploded 250-pound bomb.
Oh, wow.
And,
wow.
Yeah. And I was fresh. I was new. I don't know why I stopped. Probably for some other reason, though.
Mm-hmm.
But
whether I stopped because I saw it or I saw it soon after I stopped, I can't remember. But anyway, that was, you know, a dud that probably would have went off. And it was so big that for some reason we called somebody in and they came in the helicopter and took care of it. I suppose it's because we weren't going to mess with it. We were going to walk around it.
Right.
And they just figured it'd get somebody else. But, you know, they say they made them out of RC rations cans. We believe that. Stuff like that. I'm not an expert on that because the ones I'm familiar with exploded.
Right.
I wouldn't know how to. And the Bouncing Bettys, I would be surprised if we never, ever had those go off. But, you know. I'm thinking my squad when I was there never set off a trap, never set off one. So it was a situation where we were farther back in line when it happened because they were almost always set off by the head of the line.
Mm-hmm. Yes, sir. All right. So then your squad didn't take any casualties as a result of booby traps then?
Not when I was there.
Oh, wow. Yes, sir.
I can't think of any.
All right.
They probably half of us were wounded, but it was always during firefights.
All right. When you got into a firefight with the NVA, did they generally stand and fight a while, or were they more hit and run, kind of like the Viet Cong?
They'd stay, but you know they knew the helicopters were coming.
Mm-hmm.
You know we seldom called in artillery if we were ambushed during the day on the move. We almost always called in the choppers, and when they showed up, I think they pretty much left. You know, I saw way more helicopters shot down than I would have thought possible, but most of them were shot down when we went into the whole cab went into the Ashaw Valley in April of '68.
Okay.
And they shot down all kinds of helicopters, and I guess I don't understand why we're talking about that. You asked me about if they stayed and fight. Yeah, you know, they stayed as long as they could, but when the gunships show up, they got to get out of there.
Yes, sir. Well, how often would you guys make, combat assaults into hot LZs? Did that ever occur?
Oh, it happened all the time.
Okay.
I think to get an air medal, I'm not positive about this, by the way. I mean, you know, I was drafted. I don't really care about most of this kind of stuff. But I think to get an air medal, you had to make 8 combat assaults or something like that.
Okay, yes, sir.
And I had 8 oak leaf clusters or 8 little bronze stars, whatever the hell they were, that went on the air medal, so that's 64 if I have it right. Anyway, we made
yes,
a lot.
Yes, sir.
And, you know, we'd be out walking during the day, and maybe a helicopter would get shot down somewhere, and they'd come and the slicks would come and get us and take us there, or just change of plans type thing.
Okay, yes, sir.
And then massive combat assaults on certain places like Lang Vey. By the way, Lang Vey is the name of that Special Forces camp.
Okay, yes, sir.
Neither you or I could remember the other day.
Right.
And the Ashaw Valley, you know, where battalions were going in there and stuff like that. But mm-hmm. like I said, I must have made in the 60s of them.
Right.
Yes. Which means the company did it because I was always with the 81st and the 12th.
Mm-hmm.
As far as being hot, boy. I don't know.
Okay.
Half or a third would be, I don't think a half. That'd be too much. Yeah, that was not fun. Nobody liked that. And the birds didn't want to get real close to the ground, so you're spraining ankles, and it was, that was no fun.
Right. Yes, sir. All right. You mentioned the gunships. At this time, were they still Huey gunships, or did you guys have the Cobras at this point?
My memory is that the Cobras showed up like in the summer of '68,
okay.
But I don't think that's right. A guy that I respect said they were there in 66 in Vietnam.
Okay.
So, anyway, they were both there.
Okay. Yes, sir.
In addition with the things we called Spooky and Puffed Magic Dragon, which were gunships. One was a World War II slow-moving plane, and the other one was a Chinook. And we only called them in at night, and I don't know if that's... But they dropped illumination and all kinds of ordnance. They had same rockets as the Cobras and the mini machine guns and that kind of stuff. They were very nasty.
Yes, sir.
I think the plane was like an AC-10 or something. I don't know.
All right.
But the gunships were wonderful. They saved the day. And we were never very far away from a gunship. I mean, it could be half an hour, which is a long time when you get shot at, but...
Right.
They would come.
Yes, sir. All right. Did you guys ever come into contact, from what you could tell, with any enemy units other than, say, the VC or NVA?
I saw, the answer to that is no, but I saw what we all thought were dead Chinese in the Shaw Valley.
Interesting, sir.
They were way too big to be Vietnamese. But they were dead when I saw them.
Yes, sir. All right. Let's see. Well, before getting into some of the more specific things, did you guys ever work with the ARVN, with the South Vietnamese troops?
We made an air assault with them when we were on the in the fall of 68, when we left I Corps and went down to the Cambodian border. Well, I guess it'd be west of Song Bi area, and that's all I know is we made an air assault. They went one way, we went the other, and some lerps went another way.
Right.
They were amazing. They had live chickens tied to their packs, and I mean, they were radios blasting. Yeah, they were a little bit different.
What was your impression of them?
My impression was all the bad things I had heard about the Arvins is probably true.
Okay.
But I didn't see them fight.
Right.
Now, we almost always had I think we called them Kit Carson Scouts. We always had of course, they weren't Arvins. They were captured VC, I think.
Right.
They came over, and we had those with us a lot. Or they brought them in when we were, without question, going to get hit or already in the shit. They'd bring them in for translation. They were nasty. They were not good to the prisoners. But they were always with they moved with the CO in the middle of the column, and I don't know much about them. But we had one a lot.
From your impression, I know you said you didn't really see them very much, but did you feel that, and did other guys in the unit feel that they were trustworthy, given the fact that they were former VC?
Yeah. We probably didn't trust them.
Mm-hmm. Okay. All right.
Now, I don't know about the officers. I can't answer that.
Yes, sir. All right. Well, how about dogs? Did you guys ever go into the field with dogs and dog handlers?
I didn't hear you.
How about dogs? Did you guys ever go into the field with dogs?
Yeah. Once in a while, they'd show up. A dog handler would show up, and they'd walk point. And it mainly happened early on in my tour when we were still up north of Quantry trying to catch stragglers from Tet, and they were supposedly good at booby traps.
Okay.
I don't know. I can't remember if they found any or not.
Yes, sir. All right. Well, I know you said that you didn't come into contact with villages very often, but
no.
When you did come into contact with Vietnamese civilians, did you get much of an impression of them as far as where their loyalties lie or kind of, their views on Americans?
You know, the ones I saw were usually close to Quantry City or in Quantry City or LZ Sharon, and they were business people. They were selling us stuff, stuff like that.
Okay.
Selling us, you know, Coke and beer that they bought from rear echelon assholes, and they were probably selling their daughter for that matter. But anyway, I just think they were trying to survive. I wouldn't say they were on anybody. They were on whoever side was owning their front yard at the time, I guess.
Right, right.
I don't have bad feelings about them.
Mm-hmm. Yes, sir. All right. Okay. If we could talk a little bit more specifically now. You mentioned in the... In the questionnaire, you talked about some of the specific operations, and I know they may be difficult to distinguish. But could you talk a little bit about some of those operations? I know you talked about being up near Quezon, and also trying to block the NVA that had been involved in Tet. Could you talk a little bit more about some of those operations that you were involved in?
Well, the one blocking for Tet, I think there's just many cab companies strung out north of Quantry and near Way, doing just that, patrolling during the day and setting up at night and trying to put a more of a hurt on them that they've already had and stop them from getting back across the DMZ. The one where we went into the Quezon area was, I'm quite sure, the entire Cav and a lot of Arvins, and we aerosoled in all over the place. Let's see. We landed, I don't know, like 10 miles from Quezon and six or seven or clicks, probably, not miles, from Langvay, and in two company strength, we were with Company C, the first and 12th, along with our A company, and we just walked part of the time on the famous Highway 1, I think. Anyway, it was a red dirt, what they would call a highway, and light resistance as we went, and then we got to the lower camp at Quezon, and for some reason spent a couple of nights on that. We were a quarter of a click or a half a click from the Laos River and hence Laos. And that's when we were in contact with the guy that wrote dispatches.
We
walked up there that day, and they came in on helicopters, and I'm thinking they spent the night. I say it was artillery. It was artillery, but I mean, I'm trying to think of what the weapon's called. It's recoilless rifle, I guess. That's what it was like. They were so close. There was hardly any arc to the shell. We could hear their boom, and then almost instantly the boom by us, and we just jumped in bunkers, and it was full of dead mountain yards. And mountain yards, as you know, help protect special forces camps, and there was a lot of them that protected this one because they were so close to the right on the DMZ and right next to Laos. And then the next day we went up to the big camp, which was very big. And as I think I told you later, there was dead Americans because they didn't never have a chance to get them out until we secured the place, and then they took them out. Medal of Honor winner. I don't know. I'm thinking we stayed there 3 or 4 days.
Okay.
Birds came and got us and took us back to I Corps. Oh, well, we were still in I Corps. Never saw the Marine base.
Okay.
Never don't some, you know, some cab companies went right up to it. Let's see, what else was the big one? There's nothing bigger except for our move from I Corps to 3 Corps
which, you know, didn't culminate with a battle. The air assault into the Ishaw Valley was unbelievable.
Mm-hmm.
It's the coldest, I think, or maybe the second coldest I was in Vietnam, because we were flying so high in the birds with the no doors.
Right.
And then when we got there, it was like riding an elevator. We just went straight down and got dumped out. Some guys were rappelling because they were going into the side of the hill, and the birds didn't want to get, couldn't get close enough to drop them off. I'm pretty sure the first day, 34 Slicks got shot down.
Oh, wow.
And one C-130.
Right.
Because I'll never forget, two F-4s showed up, and they knew the hill that their anti-aircraft weapons were on. And we got on their net, because I was sitting by the captain's RTO. And he got on their net and was listening to them, and they were saying, shoot, you son of a gun, shoot. And, you know, they didn't shoot. They didn't give up their positions. So they never got the guys, that, at least not that day, that shot down all the Slicks in the C-130. We spent a day or two on the floor of the valley, and then everybody, all the cab companies, took off up into the hills and set them on the run. Some interesting things about that war: we saw a bunch of captured Russian jeeps and trucks. And there was a slick on the floor of the valley we were walking by on patrol with two stars on the front. That could have been Abrams, maybe, his bird. Anyway, there was a Bengal tiger in the hill. Dead Bengal tiger filled the floor of the slick. Just gigantic. And the Ishaw was famous for tigers and all kinds of bad stuff.
Right.
I mean, we went in there at various times, and of course the famous time the airborne outfit went in there. What the hell's the name of that movie? Where they take the hill after losing everybody and they leave it.
Right, Hamburger Hill?
Yeah, Hamburger Hill, that's in the Ishaw Valley.
Okay.
That was in the Ishaw Valley. And, you know, we'd be gone and they'd be back there if they wanted to be. And they had, you know, we found all kinds of caches of ammunition and food and medical supplies, stuff like that. By we, I mean the whole cab.
Right.
Okay, so I'd say the only other gigantic operation I was on was then when we went to the cab moved south,
okay.
October of 68.
All right.
The entire cab, because it had been, it had been around Dapto and the Central Highlands. Ted happened, and they moved the whole cab up in Wrong Way and Country in that area, and then we were going back down. To 3 Corps. I think the Central Highlands is in 2 Corps, but I'm not sure. I was never there. From that point on, we're patrolling and trying to catch the enemy coming down the trail, and we saw some pretty amazing things. We ran across a trail that was matted. As far as the eye could see, north and south, or whatever directions it was, I assume it was north and south, there was a mat probably 3.5 meters wide. The trees, where they started to thin a little bit, would be braided, you know, where the triple canopy was not as thick as it should be. They would braid the trees. It was just amazing. I never saw anything like it. To have the patience to do that is just unbelievable. I'm assuming it was a bicycle trail that, you know, the braided bamboo mats or whatever they were would let them ride their bicycles down it most of the year.
Yes, sir.
And I know I was on a listening post one day, and I saw several bicycles go down the trail.
Yes, sir.
And we weren't supposed to engage them. We were just supposed to count them. Yeah,
right.
There was like 3 in a two-hour period.
Would they have the bicycles loaded up with
supplies? Yeah, they had a carrier behind the seat, and usually an AK slightly strapped onto the handlebars.
Mm-hmm.
And I think one had, geez, I don't know what they were, but they were from the handlebars to the back fender. They had carrying some long poles or something. Mm-hmm.
You talk about being close to the border and the enemy having that sanctuary there. Did it make you guys frustrated? Did you guys talk about the fact that they had this safe place that they could go to?
Absolutely. You know how grunts are sitting around. We cared less about international borders.
Right.
You know, we thought we should go over there and get them, like the Cav eventually did, I guess, in the Arvins. But, we didn't see any reason not to, or to put it better, to bomb the hell out of them and send the helicopters over there. Maybe we'd watch, but anyway. Yeah, we didn't like that a bit.
All right. Well, of all the places that...
Hold on, I can't hear. I'm going to get another phone, okay?
Okay, sure. Yes, sir.
Hold on.
All right. Okay. Well, out of all the operations that you were involved in, was the A-Shaw the worst?
Yeah, by far.
Okay. Yes, sir.
By far. It was, regardless of the enemy, it was very, very spooky. Always fog in the mornings, and the fog looked almost like smoke, and you could hear tigers making a lot of noise at night, things like that. Mm-hmm. Just the naturalness of the place was spooky, and we knew it was loaded with the enemy.
Mm. Yes, sir.
And you know, it was so, once you got in the jungle in the elephant grass, you couldn't see a thing, hardly.
Mm.
And we got our you know, that might be the one place where they wouldn't attack the head of the column. They sometimes hit us in other places. You know, they were probably going for the CO's group, which was easy to tell with all the antennas and things.
Right.
And the radios.
Mm-hmm. You mentioned the elephant grass. About how tall would that elephant grass be? If you could guess.
I don't know if it was because it was growing or a different, there was different kinds, but it was, I'm 6'2", it was well over my head at some places, and it was waist high at other places, but it was very, very nasty. It was like razor blades. I mean, it was terrible.
Yes, sir.
It cut you up bad.
Oh, wow. Yes, sir.
The edges of it.
All right. If I remember correctly, can you tell me, is this correct that when you guys went into the A-Shaw, this was the first time any American unit had been in there in quite a long time?
Yeah, I think so.
Mm-hmm. And they had actually, the North Vietnamese had actually pretty much built it up as a base camp area.
Right,
mm-hmm.
Right. See, it was close to Laos. Wait a minute, where is it? It's, I believe it's part of the North Ho Chi Minh Trail. It's part of that, and it was hard to get to. There wasn't going to be anything but foot soldiers in there, and of course helicopters.
Right.
I'm thinking all I saw was some rudimentary bunkers, but where they got those vehicles at, I don't know. We saw that like 2 days in, and it would make sense that they'd be on the floor of the valley because they wouldn't have been any good anywhere else in that area.
All right.
But it was always known for, in fact, it was said their R&R was there. I can't imagine that. But
yes, sir.
I guess the rest part.
Right. Well, how long were you guys operating there in the valley, do you know?
3 or 4 weeks. Three weeks, 4 weeks, something like that.
All right. Was there, I guess, a lot of contact then during that time? Was it almost daily contact?
Yes. There was, oh yeah.
Mm-hmm. Sir. All right. If you don't mind me asking, did the unit, did you guys take a lot of casualties during the A-Shaw campaign?
You know, I never know how many people get wounded, but I know we had two killed.
Yes, sir.
Nobody in my squad got wounded, I don't think, or killed.
Okay.
I know we had two killed and several wounded.
Yes, sir. All right. Okay. Let's see. And that was, you listed it, you listed on the... in the questionnaire. Was that Operation Delaware? Was that the name of the...
I don't know. I bet I looked it up when I filled out the questionnaire.
Okay.
I'm sorry, I don't remember.
You said it was April of 68, right? Is when you guys went in, do you think?
Yeah, that's right.
Okay.
We did both Quezon and Asia, apparently, in April. Asia one was second, and it probably spilled over into May, maybe.
Mm-hmm. Okay. All right.
Either that or... No, it was after. It was after Quezon.
Okay. All right. Yeah, looking at the questionnaires, it says that you wrote Operation Pegasus, which I know that was involved with Quezon, in March of 68.
Oh, okay.
And then,
well,
okay.
If that's the case... Gosh, I can't imagine. Maybe that was before we went to Asia. Oh, it was. Yeah, that's right.
Because you have, I'm assuming that Operation Delaware is Asia. I don't know, but you have that as April of 68 as
okay.
The next thing. So
okay. Then that's...
Yes, sir.
That's how I remembered it, or I looked it up. Mm-hmm.
Yes, sir. All right. Was it much longer after the Asia that you guys moved south?
Yeah, it was. Until October.
Right, okay. Yes.
Yeah, so we did the next 4 or 5 months in I-Corps,
mm-hmm.
search and seizure, that type of thing. Just a couple of times we might have been in two company strength, but almost always it was just the company out.
Okay.
Walking around, trying to find something.
All right.
Like that was when we found that hospital and, you know, things like that.
Okay. Yes, sir. All right. let's see. I know you wrote in a questionnaire that you eventually became a squad leader. Do you remember at what point that took place?
Hello?
Sir?
Okay. I did eventually become squad leader, yes.
Okay.
Oh. I was older than most of the people, and in fact, I had graduated from college. I was kind of a natural choice for that, personality-wise. And everybody was, you know, there was nobody who was on their second tour or anything, so we were all in the same boat.
Right. Yes, sir.
And they knew I would tell people what to do if I had to, so that's how it was. And well, I also had the greatest point man you could imagine. That helped.
Yes, sir. All right. once you guys made the move, down, you said it was the 3 Corps, is that right?
Yeah.
Okay. Did the war change very much for you?
Yes. There was way more concentrations of NVA than we had experienced, except when we were in the Asia and near Quezon.
Yes, sir. So things actually got worse for you when you guys moved to 3 Corps?
I was just trying to think of the cow. That's when our point man got killed, for instance, which would make it terrible anyway. But I would say we were engaged with the enemy twice as much as we were up north.
Oh, wow. Yes, sir.
I mean, they were everywhere. Well, because we were near the trail, Black Virgin Mountain, there was all kinds of NVA.
Okay, right, yes, sir. So you mentioned Black Virgin Mountain. So around the Tainan area? Is that
correct? I was never there, I don't think, but
okay.
Yes. We were at a place called Song B. Once again, I suppose there was a little village there, and we had the first of the 12th Battalion headquarters there.
Okay.
It was established, so someone was there before the cab moved down there. We could see Black Virgin Mountain from there.
Okay.
And I didn't really know much about Black Virgin Mountain until I made friends with a guy who was a Special Forces guy. And I'm talking recently, not not then, and I don't know, he had two or three tours of Vietnam, and on one of them he got wounded, and when he was recuperating, they put him on top of the mountain in the comm section, or radio section. And he was telling me how we had the bottom of the mountain and the top, and they had all the rest of it. So I didn't know anything about that. I did know they had anti-aircraft weapons on that, you know, there, but I don't know.
All right. Do you remember any memorable firefights or operations after you guys moved south?
Oh yeah. Well, I don't know about operations. You know, the whole thing had a name, I'm sure. Moving south, and so that's from I left the field like the 8th of February or something. So from October, the end of October till then, we never went in any kind of operation remotely, like moving battalions and brigades and choppers to one location. There was nothing like that.
Okay.
We were mainly walk out. And it got real bad. At one point, we were the whole cab was engaging the enemy so often that we started going in two company groups. And I remember once we captured... I don't know. Up to 100 NVA, because I remember we had to sit on them and a while, and somebody came and interrogated them and blah blah blah. And then finally they brought Chinooks in and took them away. So because I remember they had lined, we didn't capture them, so it was the other company, and they had all their NVA packs lined up. And it looked like a military cemetery to me, anyway. You know, the perfectly separated things, in this case, packs. NVA packs were coveted. They were good. They were better than ours as far as they were smaller, and they rode high on your back, and a lot of guys wanted them. I don't know what happened to those.
Yes, sir.
Probably the Pokes.
Right.
Be my guess. But anyway, I may have already told you this, but that's when they were interrogating the guy dragging him on a rope underneath a slick, running in through the trees.
Okay.
I remember that.
Yes, sir.
So I suppose they thought they had a, you know, company commander or something. They might know something.
Right. Yes, sir. Go ahead.
I just want to say, I don't know how that worked, because if they would have captured me, for instance, I wouldn't have known what we were going to do the next day.
Right.
I mean, you know, we didn't know. Okay.
Right. All right. Well, any other firefights, anything like that, that we haven't mentioned yet, that stick out in your mind?
The one I was wounded in sticks out in my mind.
Okay.
That was down there. Oh, no, that wasn't. That was I-Corps. One where we were in two company group, and we lost 10 guys to our helicopters. I remember that.
Okay.
And near that time, with the same company, at night, we the closest thing I was ever into a overrun situation was at night. And another reason I remember that, they attacked us 3 separate times, and the first time I was walking around without my weapon, I remember shots started. I looked up, and a guy was in a tree very close to us with an with the rocket launcher. I just can't think of
RPG?
What it's called.
RPG?
Yeah.
Okay.
And so I thought I was dead, and someone shot him out of the tree, and the rocket went up in the air.
Mm-hmm.
But anyway, two more times that night we were hit, and the first time we called in the Phantoms, the F-4s, and there was shrapnel as big as Volkswagens flying around. At least that's what they sounded like.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, that was bad news. You know, it's interesting, because when we set up that night, as squad leader, I went up to the CO's position, and he said, "We're not sending anybody out tonight. We're not sending out any ambushes or listening posts. And I thought that was kind of weird. And the reason was, soon after we attacked, the F-4s were pounding near our perimeter. So they didn't want to have to, they didn't want us getting it from them.
Right.
And then the next two times they hit it, it was pitch dark, and we called in the ships I mentioned earlier, Puff or Small, or whatever the other one's called. And, you know, they drop the illumination and pound the area with rockets and the miniguns.
Yes, sir. Oh, right.
I went out, I think between the second and the third, I went out and set a trip flare out of where we saw they were coming, because I was good at that. I never set them off. I remember that, and that was a scary moment. I went out there with a bandolier and my M16 and all by myself and in the dark, setting up where you got to, you know, you stick the tent pole in the ground that's got the trip flare on it, and you run the wire probably 10 meters, and I can't remember how long they were, and you set that in, and then you go back and set the pin on the trip flare. But I got back in. I didn't hear anybody moving around or anything.
Sir.
And lo and behold, it did go off. It went off after the battle had started, after they were shooting at us. So it didn't act as a alarm for us. We were already knowing we were attacked.
Yes, sir. You mentioned a moment ago an incident where you guys lost 10 guys to your own helicopters. What happened there?
It was during the day. We were out hitting the trail, and they attacked us. And when the choppers came in, they talked to the forward observer. I don't know if he popped smoke or not. I can't remember. It was actually the other company, I think, that lost the 10. No, I know it was the other company that lost the 10. And he called in the birds, and they just got out of the wrong side of the smoke, if there was smoke, or the FO wasn't able to tell them where we were exactly.
Yes, sir. All right.
The interesting thing was, he's one of the 10 that died.
The forward observer.
Yeah, so he must have he was apparently traveling with the point squad, which is kind of unusual. Often they stayed with the CO's group, and they were officers. In this case, he was a Army officer calling in artillery or Army helicopters. I remember sometimes we'd have Air Force guys, and they were usually sergeants.
Okay.
They called in airstrikes. But I never saw anything but officers or FOs in the Army. But all I saw was my one little company, so I don't know.
Right. Yes, sir. Was this the only incident of friendly fire during your tour, or were there others?
I can't think of any other. I can't think of any other.
Okay.
I'm talking about my company.
Yes,
I can't
sir.
Think of any other. There, as a whole, I'm sure there were great numbers of friendly fire deaths in Vietnam and wounded.
Yes, sir. All right. So the procedure for calling in, I guess the helicopter, the gunships would be to use a smoke grenade and have them, you know, would that be to let them know where you guys were?
Yeah, and tell them fire on the, you know, north side of that or whatever. You know, I've seen times where the smoke grenade didn't get where it was supposed to, and you say disregard that smoke grenade, but generally that's what we used.
Okay.
And at night, when we set up, and I don't think we did this every night, but the FO would call in artillery, and, you know, he'd have to adjust. So where he wanted it, if we were hit at night. So, you know, that was something that happened before,
right,
before dark, so he could see the smoke and see how close it was. I don't remember any accidents from that.
Yes, sir. Oh, right. I know you also mentioned a little earlier that you were wounded. What happened there?
Our squad had point. This was when we were still in I-Corps. It was August 13th, because I know when I was wounded. And we were walking point. I was probably five guys back, maybe. And we went down a hill, crossed a stream, and was going up a hill. And I could see Mackey, the Great Point man. And all of a sudden, he's falling backwards. His body's rigid. His heels are locked. And then he fires his weapon. And then we start taking fire. And I don't know how long it lasted. Probably 15, 20 minutes. There were no helicopters involved. So this was one of those times probably where they were too far away or something. I don't know.
Yes,
but anyway, we... five of us were wounded. Nobody was killed. And they eventually took off, I guess. And we only found one body, and that was the guy that Mackey, the point man, shot at. He saw his face in a little little bunker, and he did what he did.
Mm-hmm. Yes, sir.
Pretty amazing.
Right.
He was truly amazing. I think I told Jerry he was from Red Oak, Oklahoma.
Okay, right. Yes, sir.
Choctaw. Yeah, he's a Choctaw tribe, and he was... he didn't seem like a reservation kid to me, but I don't remember that. We were real good friends. I just don't remember that. I mean, he seemed like a regular go-to-town school kind of guy, but
right.
Maybe not. I know Red Oak is definitely right in the middle of their nation down there.
Okay.
The Choctaws. I looked that up later.
All right.
But anyway, that's when I got wounded, and I got wounded from shrapnel in my right ankle, which bothered me. Well, we had to walk a long ways to get to... That's what it was. It was so damn thick, the birds couldn't come in. We had to walk four or five clicks to get through birds to get us out of there. And I don't remember carrying anybody. I don't mean me personally. I mean us.
Right.
For there to be five wounded, that's pretty lucky.
Yes.
I just don't remember. It may have occurred. And then they came and got us and took us away.
Okay. Did you have to be... were you away from the unit for a while, recovering? Or
a week.
A week, okay.
It was a piece of shrapnel in my... inside my right ankle, as opposed to the outside. They said it was half... it was the size of half a dime.
Mm-hmm. Sir. All right. Okay. How would you rate the medical treatment you received during that time that you were out?
It was okay. I mean, I went back to LZ Sharon to the... yeah, well, I don't really know. Either the battalion or the brigade medical center.
Okay.
And they said, well, it looks like you got shrapnel in there. They took an X-ray and sent me to I'm going to say about a 20-bed, I don't know about that, 16-bed mini hospital, I guess, underneath a big old tent. And then the next day, the doctor came in and told me there was shrapnel in there and said it shouldn't be a problem. And I'd sit around a few days, and then they'd send me back out to the field. So there was really no treatment except you know, I got a shower, and they fed me, and I laid around reading books, which was nice.
Right.
I don't think I could have expected more than I got. It was fine. And I was certainly not bad enough to be sent on, you know, to wherever the hell you go.
Right.
Japan, I guess, was the goal of everybody. The million-dollar wound thing.
Yes, sir. Any other memorable moments, or even funny moments, things like that we haven't discussed at this point?
Yeah.
My best friend over there, besides Mackey, or not really besides Mackey, but anyway, was Jack Fontenot.
Okay.
He was extremely funny. He's a Cajun from the Lafayette, Louisiana area. He actually grew up in a little town called Eunice, Louisiana.
Okay.
He was funny, and not very long ago, I got a call from a Marine. I once in a while write something into the First Cav or the 12th Brigade of the Cav's website, and to identify myself, I usually put I was in the first squad with. And my nickname was Colonel and blah, blah, blah. Anyway, this guy said Fontenot used to, when he was 8 and 9, he used to be in amateur talent contests, and he always did Jerry Lewis routines. But he was a pretty funny guy. Let's see. You know, I went to the vet center in Prescott, and then I go to the VA hospital in Prescott, and I just recently stopped seeing a guy, I guess I'll call her a psychologist, PhD in psychology from Wyoming University,
okay.
A Boston lady. I have the utmost respect for her, but anyway, she got me writing about Vietnam,
mm-hmm. Yes.
And I've read those to several groups and some guys at the vet center and my wife, and I know we're on the tape, but I was wondering if it would be any value to you if you got the time. I don't care, but if I read them to you or something, or some of them, or
sure, yes, sir, absolutely.
And they have humor in them. They document some humorous moments.
Mm-hmm.
I'd be more than happy to sit here with the phone someday and just read them to you.
Sure.
I mean, I haven't read them in a long time. I don't think today would be a good idea.
Okay, that's fine. We can certainly schedule another session and do that if you'd like to.
I'd like to do it, but only if you think it might have some value. Okay.
Absolutely, yes, sir. Okay. All right. Well, we can plan another time to do that.
Okay.
All right. Let's see. Another thing I wanted to ask you: you mentioned an incident where you guys came in contact with a water buffalo. Could you
talk
about what happened there?
That was soon after we got off the choppers in the Quezon area, and we start making our way to Langrae.
Okay.
I was behind a guy called Duckett, who was from Tennessee, and he was along with a guy named Cox. They were my mentors. They were guys with 8-9 months in, you know, spent all their time in A Company, 1st to 12th, and they were good troopers. But anyway, I was behind him. We're walking the normal 3 meters apart or 2 meters apart, whatever that would be, and there's a big old water buffalo over there. Besides our company walking, we could see another company a ways over doing, you know, walking, going south, and we were going, either west or east, I can't remember. And all of a sudden, this buffalo starts snorting and getting mad, and he starts charging. And he's, you know, charging our column. And Duckett says, stop, Kern. And we both stop, and of course, the people behind us stop. The ones in front of us probably took a while to stop. And at some point, Duckett realizes one of us is going to get hurt.
Yes.
So the bull comes at him, and he empties 18 rounds into that buffalo's head and chest, and that's the end of that buffalo. Unfortunately, he was so close to Duckett that when he fell, his horn opened up his pants from his belt to his knee on his right side.
Wow.
Unfortunately, because it's not easy to get another pair of pants, but
right. That's
how close he was to... he shot... You know, I would have thought that he would have dropped before then, but
yeah.
No. Anyway, I didn't get a round off. I must admit, I was frozen.
Uh-huh.
I was not...
And I was a rookie, so I'll charge it up to rookie.
Right.
Anyway, that's the Buffalo story.
Okay.
It's true, and it was on the way to Lang Bay.
Mm. All right. All right. Well, any other memorable moments that we should mention at this point that we haven't?
When I first got to the company, we decided that the first platoon, we split the company up, and the first platoon was going to go off trying to hunt down elephants that the NVA had used to bring stuff down for Tet.
Uh-huh.
And they assumed they were taking stuff back after Tet. And we could hear them at night, or maybe during the day, both. I don't remember that. But anyway, I was the shooter, they decided, because I was the one who had shot a bazooka down in Tigerland.
Okay.
So they bring us a bazooka and maybe, oh boy, 6 or 8 rounds for it. And
okay.
For 2 or 3 days we're out chasing elephant crap and trying to see where they went through the elephant grass, and we never found one. Boy, I would not have liked to have shot an elephant, I can tell you that.
Right.
You know, not that many years away from the circus, I don't think I'd have liked to have shot it, but
sure.
We never found it, so we didn't have to do that. And a couple of days later, a chopper shows up and we throw the bazooka and the rounds on there, and that's that. And it was an old weapon. This was not some modern weapon. It looked like World War II movie weapon. And we didn't practice fire either, which I found quite amazing.
Right.
I thought maybe we should have done that, but we didn't.
Sir. All right. Well, did you get a chance to go on R&R?
Yeah. Yeah, I went to Hong Kong.
Okay.
Yeah, that was good. I liked that.
All right.
Yeah.
Is that a week-long leave? Or?
I was probably away from the company for a week.
Okay.
I think you're only in on R&R 5 days, 4 nights, that
okay.
type of thing.
Yes,
but, you know, I called home from the hotel room and hamburgers and beer. It was good.
All right. Well, anything else we should say before moving on to going home and after Vietnam?
Fontenot left the company when we were out in the bad stuff near the Cambodian border about a week before I was set to leave.
Okay.
And the night he was leaving at night, there, you know, you got to hump that last day. You can't go in the morning when the bird comes. Anyway, he gets on the bird after we're all saying goodbye, and I'm, you know, 2-3 weeks from them, if I survive, I'm going to be down in Eunice, Louisiana for his wedding.
Mm-hmm.
But anyway, he gets on the bird, and I see him talking to the guy in the main seat, so I don't know what that's all about. And they take off, and they don't take off very. They don't get out of there real fast, and they're circling the company. And then I see him hanging on the door with one hand, and he's pissing on us. He's got his tool out, and he's urinating on A Company, first to 12th. And that's Fontenot.
Yeah.
He's a funny guy. Unfortunately, he died of a cancer about 20 years ago. It's one of the ones connected with Agent Orange.
Mm. Oh, no.
But that's all I know about that. I don't know if the VA agreed with that or not.
Yes, sir. Did you guys... were there times when you guys knew you were being exposed to Agent Orange?
Yeah. Yeah, we got actually sprayed a couple of times.
Oh, really?
Wow. Which I thought was... I didn't quite understand that. But we certainly slept in it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I mean, we could tell it was sprayed that day, and we'd set up, and no one gave a damn. And, of course, there was times when you could see everything was dead, and we were walking through it and sleeping in it. So, I don't know what the time frame is on how long it's dangerous.
Yes, sir.
Probably a long time.
Right.
That's all I know about it. I don't know much about it, but a couple of times we'd be walking and these little planes would show up and they're spraying their area and they come to us and they keep spraying.
Yes, sir. Well, what was out processing like? Did you go out in the field up until the very end?
Yeah. I mean, I left the field, went to my Vatsangi battalion base camp, and I don't know what I did there. I probably got some stuff from them. Boy. I don't know if I went to the division headquarters or not. I don't even know if it was still in the place when I came in country or not. And anyway, it was Kamon Bay that I left from.
Okay.
There's two interesting stories from that.
Okay.
One of them is I ran into a buddy from Tigerland. A guy that was in my squad in Tigerland who had been in the Cav. And he was on crutches. There was something the matter with one of his feet. I don't remember if it was hostile or what it was. But anyway, we went to a chaplain to see if I could get assigned on the same plane as him so I could carry his stuff and help him out and stuff like that.
Right.
And the guy chased. He just assumed we had ulterior motives for wanting to go together.
Right.
Wouldn't help us. So I remember that. And the other thing was, I spent a long time, and I think I spent 4 nights in Kamon Bay before I left.
Really?
So I spent, a couple of days more than a year in Vietnam, I think. But anyway, there was four of us at a table those 4 nights. I was the only one that was there every night. It alternated between people I knew from my company who was coming back from being wounded or from R&R, that kind of thing. And we drank 120 bottles of champagne in those 4 nights. And the reason we knew is we kept the corks and counted them the last night. I don't know how we could count them.
Right.
And, who knows how big the bottles were. But and I do remember this. They cost $1 a bottle in the... I don't know if it was the NCO club. I would have been able to go in there. I don't know. But anyway, those two things I remember from getting out of Cameron Bay.
Right. Yes, sir.
And we got on what looked like, for all intents and purposes, a commercial flight. Stopped once somewhere in Japan. And landed the same air base I took off from Fort Lewis. I guess it was an Air Force base. I really don't know what it was,
mm-hmm.
the name of it. And anyway, I go to Fort Lewis I'm thinking one night. And then I go to the airport with that same guy on crutches. We met up again somewhere along the line. And I don't know. It seems like we were around the airport for 8 hours or so, and finally I got out of there. I don't know if it was a direct flight or not. I can't remember. But I know it was damn near empty when we landed in Omaha, my hometown, at 3 in the morning, and there was a blizzard in progress. But I did get a cab to my mother and father's place, and I know I had to walk the last couple of blocks because he couldn't make it up a hill. But I had called them from the airport because I figured, what the hell, I'm going to wake them up anyway.
Right.
And I show up there, and big reunion, and go to bed.
Yes, sir.
That's how I got back.
All right. Well, in your transit back to the States, did you run into any of the anti-war protest type of things? Did you come across any of that?
No.
Okay.
No, I know people, I know a couple of guys who didn't get it on the West Coast but got it in Chicago.
Okay.
And I didn't need to go through Chicago, so I didn't have it.
Right.
Believe me, there was very little anti-war protests in Omaha ever that I'm aware of, aware of. So, no, I never did.
Right.
Of course, after that,
okay.
I never broadcast that I served in the military or certainly in the infantry, and I was that way for probably most of my life.
Yes, sir.
Till I got here where it seems to be... I moved from the Omaha area to Prescott, Arizona area 5 years ago.
Okay.
And there's a big veteran presence here. And then
My neighbor was telling me about the VA, and he said, "Did you serve?" I said, "Yeah." He says, "By any chance, did you have a Purple Heart?" I said, "Yeah." He says, "You can get free eyeglasses. You can get your glasses there." So I did that.
Right.
And from that, I started going there as my primary medical thing, even though I've got, you know, expensive insurance and Medicare.
Right.
And then I started going to the vet center, which was good for me, real good for me.
Yes, sir. All right. So prior to moving to Arizona, did you really talk to anyone much about your experiences in Vietnam?
No.
Okay.
I had one buddy that was a combat veteran, not infantry, but he was on a, you've probably talked to guys that did this, a deuce and a half trucks with either quad or dual M, or not AM, 50 caliber machine guns on the backs of them.
Okay.
So they were usually around base camps and that kind of thing. They weren't out in the woods with that.
Right.
But he, you know, he had a Purple Heart, and he was in battles, and we talked about it once in a while.
Right. All right. Did anyone else ever ask you about your experiences?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I've had people ask me, relatives ask me, and I just say, yeah. Mm-hmm. I just said, I don't have anything to say about it.
Right. Yes, sir. Was it, I guess at that time period up until recently, I know I've talked to a lot of other veterans who have said something similar, but was it a feeling that, you know, this is just something that, just based on everything that happened and the response when you guys came home from Vietnam, it was just something that you just didn't want to bother with talking about?
I'd say there was two reasons. One was I didn't want to get emotional, which I probably would have gotten if I got into it in depth.
Mm-hmm.
And secondly, I didn't think they had the right to know anything about it.
Okay. Yes, sir.
It's part of the, if you're not in the infantry, then to hell with it.
Right.
If you didn't experience it, I'm not going to tell you about it.
Mm-hmm. Yes, sir.
I'm a hardcore person about that.
Sure.
Probably unreasonably so, but anyway, that's how I felt.
Right. Yes, sir. Well, if you don't mind me asking, what changed? What made you decide to, for example, do this?
Going to the vet center.
Okay.
You know, I thought if you know, I don't know if I should say this or not, but I thought I was a bad person. I never connected how I felt about things and what I thought about, and maybe sometimes how I acted with service in Vietnam. I just never thought about it. And I never ever thought about post-traumatic stress disorder. You know, never thought about it, never studied it or anything. And I got here, started going to the vet center, start listening to people just like me.
Right.
Who were there just when I was there. Guys who were on caisson when I was five clips away and, you know, stuff like that. I realized that maybe I'm not such a terrible person, or at least if I am a terrible person, there's a good reason for it. A reason beyond me being innately bad, and it helped me a lot. And I think my wife would tell you it probably helped me a lot.
Yes, sir.
I'm one of those weird people who go to the vet center who's been married once for 40 years.
Yes, sir. All right.
But you know, I have flashbacks and nightmares. Strike the flashbacks. I don't know if I had flashbacks or not. Nightmares and all that kind of stuff I had for years. And, the things where you are awake, but you have intrusive thoughts, that's what the shrink calls them. I've had those forever.
Okay. Yes, sir. All right. Well, I guess if you don't mind, talk a little bit about life after Vietnam, after you got home. Did you have much difficulty adjusting based on what you're talking about now?
Well, I didn't. I probably didn't adjust. I didn't want to do any, whatever my life's work was going to be, I wasn't ready to start it.
Okay.
So I worked as a cement finisher, and construction jobs, and just partied, I would say.
Mm-hmm.
Probably did that until I got married, which was a year later, and didn't really stop partying after that, but I finally got a decent job, and then in 73, I went to work for the federal government for the Social Security Administration, and
okay.
worked there for 31 years.
Yes, sir. All right. Did you follow the war closely in the media after you got home?
I don't know if closely is the right word, but I followed it.
Okay. All right. What was your reaction to the developments after you left, and particularly the way the war ended?
Well, you know, I was a kid who grew up on World War II movies. I thought we were supposed to win the thing. Korea, I guess, didn't end much different in a way. Didn't have any effect on me. I thought we should have won the war. And, you know, I was lucky enough to fight in areas where there was no... You didn't have to call anybody and ask them if you could shoot and that sort of thing.
Right.
But no, you know, there was few villages around. And like I told you, so that was good. I didn't experience what guys I've talked to since had experienced, where you could hardly, you know, fight the war without begging somebody to let you do it. Yeah.
Right.
That part was ridiculous. And, you know, I've read about it since, and I don't really remember us turning down the South Vietnamese, not sending any more money and stuff like that. So maybe I didn't hardly follow it much at all once the American troops got out of there, I didn't much pay attention to it.
Okay. Yes, sir. All right.
I'll say one thing that's bothered me a long time, and it's not exactly what you're talking about, but I never sent a letter or a care package back to my squad after I left, and I damned if I can figure out why. And I can't believe that Fontenot and I didn't get together and send one when we were together in Louisiana. But anyway,
yes, sir.
I didn't, and no one else ever did either that I know of, but that doesn't change anything.
Right. Yes, sir. Well, this may be a silly question, but going back to the time when you left, how did you feel about leaving?
I was happy to get out of there. It didn't bother me to be leaving them. I'm trying to think when the Mackie was dead. I would say the next one who was going to leave after me had like 5 months to go.
Okay, right.
So I probably wasn't as close. But the guys that I were close to were gone, and one of them was leaving with me.
Okay.
Henry Allen from New Mexico. He got there a couple of days after me, but he was leaving the field as soon as me.
Yes, sir.
I don't remember feeling bad about leaving them.
Okay.
I just felt too good about getting out of there alive. I didn't think I was going to get out of there alive.
Right. Yes, sir. Have you made contact with a lot of the guys you served with since then?
I talked to Fontenot for probably 10 years, and I don't know what happened. We just didn't talk anymore, and I can't find anybody else. Except one guy who I called who was in a directory of the first cab, and he didn't remember me, which is impossible. I was Big Mouth, his squad leader. You know, I didn't identify myself as Colonel. He probably only knew me as Colonel. Fontenot was the nicknamer, and my last name's Curran, so somehow it became Colonel.
Okay.
And, that's all anybody ever called me. The captain called me Colonel.
Okay. Yes, sir.
So he, you know, I had a hard time calling him and talking to him. I was emailing a guy who was the company commander's RTO for a while. You know,
that just fizzled out. Kind of. We weren't friendly or good friends or anything, but he had some pictures of the squad I was in, and me and Fontenot and Mackie. But then I just quit Email Wonder. He quit Email Wonder. I don't know which.
Yes, sir.
So I can't find anybody else. There, none of them are in the, any of the places I look.
Okay. Yes, sir. So no reunions or anything like that?
I haven't gone to any. But okay. Here's the other thing. I was 3 or 4 years older than the second oldest one.
Okay.
So I'm figuring, and maybe I'm just rationalizing, but I'm figuring they're still working and not going to reunions. I don't see any indication that they're going to reunions. There's always a list.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
You know, with the way Fontenot died, I'm kind of concerned why I can't find these guys. It's not real hard to find people on the Internet.
Right. Yes, sir.
You know, at least an address or something.
Well, before wrapping up this part of the interview, I have some fairly broad questions to ask you about some of the larger issues surrounding the war. Get your take on those, if you don't mind.
That's all right.
All right. Well, looking back on your service and in participation in the war, how do you feel about your service in Vietnam, and also how do you feel about American involvement?
I thought I don't think it was anything like Iraq. I thought we were following the precepts of the CETO treaty, and that we had a right to be there, and that they wanted us to be there. The South, of course.
Right.
Would say that as far as my service is concerned, I'm not unhappy that I served. I'm not happy that I served, but I will always be unhappy with the draft system, and I thought it was ludicrous. I thought it should have been like World War II. If you get drafted, you get drafted. It didn't matter if you were going to school or not.
Right. Yes, sir.
But, you know. That's how I feel. But I think we had the right to be there. I think they wanted us there. And, there's folks that have written about that war, field great officers that have written about that war that aren't very proud of the officer corps in that war. And I certainly don't know anything about that above company level, but that's kind of unfortunate. And it's certainly unfortunate that the few officers who did go on the field only spent 6 months in the field. That's ridiculous. They were just getting, if they were going to get good, they were just getting good. And then they'd take them out, give them some stupid job in the rear.
Yes, sir. How about the way, from your perspective as an infantryman, how about the way the war was handled, the way it was fought? Do you think that was the right way to go about doing it, or was there a better way?
Well, of course, at the time, we all thought, we heard about what was going on in other places, how they couldn't fire on people they knew were the enemy and stuff like that. We thought that was ridiculous. However, in retrospect, you don't want to kill the people you're there to help, that's for sure. You don't want to hurt the people you're there to help.
Right.
And they were, a lot of people, a lot of my fellow infantrymen thought they were all the enemy, and of course, they weren't remotely all the enemy. I thought we should have gone into Laos and Cambodia.
Okay.
I think we should have, the ambassadors and president should have told them we were going to spend some time with them and said, at the end, we're going in. And I think we should have done that. And I think we should have, if you want to know I guess it's a tactic or a strategy, we should have gone in at 101st in the first cab in their helicopters, and we should have gone beyond where they were and worked towards Vietnam and mm-hmm. did as much damage as we could have.
Right. Yes, sir. All right.
And I understand why we didn't go into North Vietnam,
And maybe that's why we didn't go to any of the other countries. But I don't know if Russia and China would have entered a war if we would have. And I don't know if they would have if we would have went north of me. No, but I believe that's one of the major excuses.
Yes, sir. Yes, sir. All right.
And it makes sense. We didn't need World War III.
Right. Yes, sir. All right. What did you think of the media's coverage of the war, the way the war was handled through the television newspapers?
Well, I had respect for the people who were over there if they went out in the field. Not that I thought they should have gone out in the field, but the guys who hung around Saigon and just did that, you know, they who didn't talk to the people out in the field, they were probably all against whatever we were doing. But the ones who went out and talked to us and realized we were pretty much like them.
Right.
You know, I don't think they undermined the effort that badly.
Yes.
You know, I just don't think they did. But I think the people who hung around Saigon and did that, they were probably anti-war. And I despise Walter Cronkite.
Okay. Yes, sir.
I mean, if he's stupid enough to think we lost Tet, then I can't have any respect for it. Well, we put so much hurt on them during Tet, it's not even funny.
Yes, sir. All right. Well, along similar lines, what did you think of the anti-war movement?
Well, I didn't respect them as an intellectual movement. I thought they were more interested in screwing and smoking dope.
Okay.
I think that was the prime motive for most of the people in the anti-war movement, except they certainly didn't want to go themselves.
Right.
I mean, I don't ascribe to them high moral motives for their actions.
Right. So, in other words, then, trying to, I guess, have as much fun as they can and avoid serving in Vietnam themselves, and it had nothing to do with their feelings towards the Vietnamese and towards the war itself.
I think most of them were that way.
Okay.
I'm sure there were some that were, and probably the leaders were serious.
Okay. Yes, sir. All right.
The folks who came back from Vietnam and protested, I have mixed feelings for. I don't know how I feel about them.
Okay. Right.
Because they did, they walked the walk. They certainly have the right to talk, more so than the sophomores in college do. But
right.
I somehow thought they were traitorous to their brother infantrymen. I don't know. That doesn't really make a lot of sense, but I don't know.
Okay. Yes, sir. All right. Well, what do you think about U.S. policy towards Vietnam today, with the trade and travel and veterans going back? What do you think?
Yeah, that's okay. Why not?
All right.
Yes. You know, that's fine. I wouldn't go back there because I assume it costs. I could take a nicer vacation than I would think. So I would never go there, but it actually has nothing to do with my fighting there. It's not a place I'd go to.
Mm-hmm. Yes, sir. Oh.
And I don't know if I told you this or not, but the guy that got killed in the hole by the South China Sea, I've talked to his daughter several times. She goes over there and builds churches.
Oh, really?
She was born not long before he died. She never saw him.
Mm-hmm. Yes, sir.
Yeah, she's kind of a saint.
Yes, sir. All right. Have you ever visited the Vietnam Wall? And if so, what did you think of it?
I visited it, and I loved it. And I went there with a group from the vet centers in Arizona called Operation Freedom Bird. For about 20 years, they've been taking patrons from the vet center back to the wall over Veterans Day. They usually take 40.
Mm-hmm.
No expenses for the veterans.
Yes, sir.
Southwest Airlines pays a great deal of it, and they beg money around the valley, you know, Phoenix and those areas. And, you know, I give them some money once in a while, and that was great. So you're there with your consular, you might say.
Right.
And it's nice. And we would meet at night and talk about it. Joe Galloway, the reporter who went into the with Colonel Moore, the famous battle in 65.
Yes, sir.
He gave a talk. He's a hell of a guy. And the movie We Were Soldiers Once. You know that?
Yes, sir.
Okay. That's right. Joe Moore. That's Joe Galloway.
Yes, sir.
Let's see. We went to the... It was the 225th or something anniversary of the founding of the Marine Corps. We went to the Marine headquarters, the largest brass statue in the world of the raising of the flag of Iwo Jima, and watched the ceremonies there.
Yes, sir.
Went to the Tomb of the Unknown, went to, which happens to be just up the hill from Artie Murphy's grave. We went there. Went to the wall at night, which is pretty amazing.
Right.
So. It was a good trip. And the thing was, when they were doing the wall, I hated the idea of it. I thought they were making it so you couldn't see the damn thing. They were ashamed of it, blah, 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 but I changed my mind.
Yes, sir. All right. All right. You mentioned the movie We Were Soldiers. Are there any other movies or books that stick out in your mind that you could mention that you liked or hated?
Platoon is perfectly staged. It looks exactly like how we looked.
Okay.
He was there in 68, actually. He was in the 25th Infantry, I think. You know, I'm not talking about the plot. I don't mean that at all.
Right.
Well, We Were Soldiers. That's a big movie. Hamburger Hill, I could never understand what they were saying. I thought the sound was so terrible in that movie.
Right.
I just couldn't figure, you know, I knew the story. Okay, Dispatches is a great book. Night of the Silver Stars is the tale of Lang Vey. It's very good.
Mm-hmm. Yes, sir.
Fields of Fire by the senator from Virginia is good.
Yes, sir.
Is there one called the 13th Valley?
Yes, sir.
Del Vecchio?
Right, that's,
okay, that's a cab. That's good. That's a good book. The, you know, I was amazed when I found out he wasn't in the infantry. He was a press guy. He was in the service in the first cab, I believe, or maybe not, but anyway, that's a good book.
Okay.
The Cat from Way is a good book by a newsman. I've read a lot of them. Let's see. Oh, I like Hackworth's books.
Right.
One about his Army career and one about his tour in Vietnam.
Yes, sir.
And let's see. There's a book, and it's about the careers of four guys who were in Vietnam. Ollie North. I don't know why. I can't think of the senator from Virginia's name.
Is it Webb?
Webb, yeah. I've emailed the guy. We used to email back and forth before he ran for politics. Ollie North, Webb, the senator, oh, my God, McCain, and one other guy. It's a tremendous book, and I can't think of the name of it, but it's got a bird in the title.
Okay.
Like Mockingbird or Bluebird or something. That is an amazing book. It follows them through the service academies and then on to Vietnam and a little bit later.
Hmm.
Ollie North and Webb fought for the lightweight championship of Annapolis.
Oh, really?
Stuff like that.
Wow.
It's really amazing.
Right.
The connection between those guys. You should look that up. That's a good book. Let's see. Oh, it's called the Nightingale Song.
Okay, yeah, okay, yeah.
Yeah, that's a good book. Oh, A Rumor of War. That's the first book I read about Vietnam by the Caputo, the Marine platoon commander. And why I'm waiting for the last to talk about this, and I can't think of his name, but, oh, my God. The Things We Carried?
Right. Tim O'Brien.
Right,
yeah.
He is the preeminent writer about Vietnam, in my opinion.
Okay.
I mean, he's written three books to deal with combat. If I Die in a Combat Zone,
right.
Things We Carry, and then his main novel, which I can't think of. He's good. He was an Army grunt.
Yes, sir. All right.
But Dispatches is real good, too. That and O'Brien, I'll put up there.
Okay. Yes, sir. All right. Well, is there anything else we should cover today before taking a break until next time we're... If you wanted to, I'd definitely like to hear those stories.
That's up to you.
Okay.
You'll laugh once in a while. They're pretty good.
Okay.
Yeah, I'd like to do that. It might take a while. It might take an hour and a half.
Okay, that's perfectly fine.
Okay, all right. I don't know. I can't think of anything. I get worn out doing this.
Sure. Sure, understandable. All right, well, in that case, I'll go ahead and bring the interview to a close today, and we can continue with those stories at another time.
Okay.
All right.